There's a legend round here. A killer buried, but not dead. A curse on Crystal Lake. A death curse. Jason Voorhees' curse. They say he died as a boy, but he keeps coming back. Few have seen him and lived. Some have even tried to stop him. No one can. People forget. He's down there, waiting.
It is Friday, January the 13th, 2006, and you're listening to
Dead Pit. www.deadpit.com. Welcome to the Friday the 13th special live broadcast.
Yeah, this is, I know I made a post on, you know, message board and MySpace and stuff like that about it being a half hour show, but since that time it's sort of, you know,
it's taking on a life of its own, really.
Yeah, so this show, however long it is how long it's going to be. Okay. Yeah, we have no idea. We talked to Harry Manfredini for an hour last night. We talked to Paul Kratka for over 20 minutes. And Randy, who is our protege with the horror newsletter, he talked to Betsy Palmer for 30 minutes. And you're going to hear all that stuff. Whatever we have is what you're going to hear. This is sort of something that I come up with. Had a good idea of doing it about 2 weeks ago, 2 or 3 weeks ago. And I was like, yeah, let's try to get some people from the show. And I'm really, you know, pleased to know that we got the people we have. So, I guess the first thing we should talk about is just exactly what Friday the 13th, the franchise, did for horror films. Mm-hmm.
Around 1980, with the direct purpose of copying the success of the Halloween format, Victor Miller wrote the script for the first Friday the 13th. And without knowing it, created pretty much the archetype for every other slasher movie that would come along after that.
Yeah, I mean, as he, Uncle Bill said last week, and by the way, this is the Creepy Kentuckian.
And I'm Uncle Bill.
He mentioned, if you grew up in the 80s, you pretty much, and you liked horror movies, you were a fan of Friday the 13th. That's just the bottom line.
It was the most popular slasher franchise that there was, and probably got more exposure than any other franchise. And going to the movies, there were basically two franchises that every kid growing up during that era went to see horror movie related, and that was Friday the 13th and Nightmare on Elm Street. I mean, you had Freddy, you had Jason, that was it.
Although I kind of feel that Friday the 13th was probably a better franchise overall.
It was. The movies were definitely altogether better.
Not to go into Nightmare on Elm Street, but pretty much after Nightmare 4, that series sort of fell apart. I mean, there wasn't, you know, there were, Dream Child sucked ass, flat out. And the rest of them after that were worse. But anyway, with Friday the 13th, I felt that the series, it stayed the same up until part, what, Jason Goes to Hell, sort of.
Yeah, after part 8. And actually, in part 8, Jason Takes Manhattan, you can pretty much tell that it's a little bit leaning toward the, well, for lack of a better word, stupid.
I guess, yeah, the
it kinda,
the executives that were behind Paramount, and they sort of lost interest, I suppose, after that. And they sold the franchise to New Line, which, I don't know. I mean, I'm not going to go into great detail about those films yet, but I'll say that 1 through 8 is the Friday the 13th series that I remember growing up, and it's, in my eyes, it's the best horror franchise going.
Basic formula, okay?
Yeah.
Here it is, and this is a good formula for everybody that directs horror movies today to think about, too, if they want to make, you know, a really good, successful horror film. Eli Roth. Now,
had to bring up Eli Roth.
The basic format was a group of kids. You get a group of unknown actors, possibly, well.
Yeah, it's a simple formula, actually. Yeah.
Group of unknown actors. You put them together. They're usually friends and possibly ex-lovers. You send them up to a destination. In this case, it was a camp. Okay? You give them little jobs to do.
And you have to have the designated crazy old guy that's going to tell them, it's got a death curse, or something like that. You
have to have the guy that comes in with the premonitions that they're all going to get killed and lets them know before any of the killing begins. Yeah.
And you notice that is throughout most of the movies.
Yeah, that's not just Friday the 13th, really. But
Friday the 13th, you know, it started it, at least from what I can remember. Like, it's the first one.
If the crazy Ralph character, yeah.
Yeah, and then you got the... I think the character's name's Abel in the third one. The guy with the eyeball.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I don't know.
Okay, so you get them together at a camp. You introduce the killer, which by the time of the second movie, you knew it was Jason. So, you know, it pretty much stayed the same. You know, you knew what to expect. The only thing that changed was he picked up the mask in the third movie. The hockey mask that everybody now knows. You end up having a lot of sex, a lot of drugs, a lot of decapitations and machetes and chainsaws and anything else you can think of. And at the end, you know, the killer dies, but not really.
Yeah.
That's your basic formula.
Yeah. And there's always an extra scare at the very end of some sort, you know.
Well, I know that in part three... You had the machete to the head, the side of the head.
Yeah.
That was part three.
Yeah. No, so, it was the axe, actually.
Oh, it was the axe?
Yeah.
Oh, Lord.
Remember the, she hits him in the head with the axe, right? And his arms are out to grab her or whatever. But anyway, you know, it's, that's part of the reason I wanted to do just a special show on the Friday the 13th films is because, you know, it was probably the one franchise growing up that I remember watching multiple times. And even to this day, I mean, I can watch most of them, and I've probably seen the films dozens of times each. But it's just a special franchise, and we wanted to do something special. So we're going to play a little clip now from the Betsy Palmer interview.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if many of you know this fact or not, but when Siskel and Ebert reviewed the original Friday the 13th, Gene Siskel told the fans of Betsy Palmer to write to her. He gave out her home address on the show to write to her and tell her how disgusted they were. So we basically asked Betsy Palmer, you know, what she thought about Gene Siskel giving out that kind of information and if she got any letters from fans. So here's her response to that.
Gene Siskel. Yeah. That was after that was after Friday the 13th happened. I never saw the article that he, the thing that he wrote.
Right.
I heard about it, but I heard about it years later. I didn't hear about it at that time. But he had a fit and said, how dare she, you know, do this, this kind of a character when we had this image of her all these years. I don't know exactly what the emotions, those were the words.
Right.
But, you know, people are crazy. And even on the first Playhouse 90 that was ever done, which was the first hour and a half live television show, I did the lead opposite Jackie Gleason.
Okay.
In Soroyan's Time of Your Life, where I played a prostitute. I played a whore. A good on television again, you played a prostitute. I mean, you're an actress, for God's sake, you know? You're supposed to do all kinds of roles, which I have done all my life.
I guess the question, the answer would be that, that you never really received any mail from that.
Not really. Okay. No. Everybody liked it. Look, 25 years later, big cult film. I'm the queen of the slashers. But you know, you never see me kill anybody in the movie.
That's correct.
Not one person do you see me kill. I'm the one that loses my head in the end. But I never kill anybody in that movie. And I decided the reason why, it only came to me maybe a couple of months ago, that why everybody loves Mrs. Voorhees. I can't tell you how people hug me and have these autograph signing things and all, say, oh, we love you. And not just the kids, the older people too. But I've decided she's the perfect mother. Not only will she kill for her son, she'll die for him.
Right.
And isn't that what every kid wants their mother to do at some point in time?
That was the first bit of Betsy interviewing. If you want to hear the whole thing, or not hear the whole thing, but, you know, read the whole thing, you can check it out at whorenewsletter.com. So I guess we'll go on. What we're going to talk about now is pretty much the films as a whole. The first Friday the 13th, and I want to be honest with you here, you know, at least for me, the first film, when I first saw it, you know, I don't think a child around my age could really understand how good of a film it was, because, you know, I was used to just seeing Jason killing people. That's what a little kid wants to see, or a little deranged kid like I was wanted to see.
A lot of people don't realize that Jason wasn't even in the first movie. I mean,
well, he was, but he was just
he wasn't the killer in the first movie, I guess. I should say.
But the first movie is really, you know, it is sort of a clone to Halloween, but there's a lot of, like, interesting things about the movie. Especially, I thought the music was really well done in the movie. I mean, we were talking to Mr. Manfredini about this last night, which you'll hear the interview in just a few minutes. The way he used the music, especially in the end, you had Adrian King out there in the middle of a lake, and I don't know what time of year it was when they were filming the movie, but it was this peaceful lake scene as I can remember. It was just like a painting, sort of. And especially, I'm sure at the time when the film first came out, people were like, "Oh, it's just, you know, it's the dramatic ending. You're going to see the credits roll up," but. And especially with the music that he plays in it, which Sail Away, Tiny Sparrow, or something like that he called it. And you just see her in the boat laying. She gets up, and she thinks she's safe. Then you hear the terrifying music, and you see Mongoloid Jason jump up behind her and grab her. So I can imagine the type of terror that caused when someone first saw that in the theater. I mean, it's really well done. You don't see movies like that know when to cue the music and know what to do with it. You know,
that movie had a lot of things going for it in a lot of different areas. And one of those things was it had Savini doing the makeup for it. You had a classically trained actress, Betsy Palmer, you know, doing the main role. You had Manfredini doing the score, which that score is probably as memorable now as Halloween or Jaws or any of those other really memorable horror movie scores. And you actually had a really good director, you know, in Cunningham. Some of the best scenes in that movie are actually based around not so much the death scenes, although there are some good ones. I mean, Kevin Bacon scene is classic by now. Just the fact Kevin Bacon was in that movie is classic. Mm-hmm. The scenes with the lake and, you know, around the lake, and actually the flashback scenes with Jason drowning and stuff, they're all really well shot and well lighted, and it was just...
Especially with the music, where the film was on such a low budget, the music, and really Cunningham's vision, made it seem like a high-budget film. I mean, it really didn't, even to this day, if you really think about it, that movie was made over 25 years ago, and it was a low-budget movie then. What will a movie like The Fog remake, for instance, look like in 25 years? Movies today, they just don't have that kind of lasting power. I mean, there's nothing in that film that looks, you know, aged, really. I mean, it's really, really well done film. But let's go on to part two, because this is going to be a long freaking show as it is. Okay?
Seriously.
So we've got like...
You guys.
We've got freaking like 12, 11 movies to talk about here, so...
And while we're going through these movies, I just want to say, honestly, this would be a good time for people to start using the email function on their computers to start giving us some comments and suggestions about the show. Right. We have, seriously, 3 interviews on this show, and we're reviewing every single one of the Friday 13th movies. I mean, give us some feedback. It's, you know, about time that starts to happen a little bit more.
Yeah, well this isn't a traditional review. We've got the DVDs and shit in front of us, and we're just telling you basic shit that we remember from the movie and what we like.
Yeah, we're not.
So we don't have a big report made out for this shit. So
no, we're not gonna go like Jeffrey Lyons on your ass or anything.
That's right.
We're just, you know.
But after this review here, we're going to talk to we're going to play that interview that we did, or half of the interview, since it's an hour long, but it's a great interview, and we think all the true Friday the 13th fans will enjoy that with Harry Manfredini. But we're on Friday the 13th, part 2.
This Tater Sack Jason, that's all I'm saying.
Yeah, the Jason with the, you know, I guess it's a tater sack. What else can I call it?
It's a burlap sack.
Burlap sack with a hole in it so I can see. He's only got one eye anyway. He only needs one hole.
Uh-huh.
He's got another eye, but it doesn't work.
This is what introduced people to what has been called the inbred Jason. You know, the first film was supposed to be the mongoloid Jason character. And I remember this film being the inbred Jason. And you only get to see that for, I think, it's 30 seconds at the end of the movie.
Yeah, this was supposedly set 5 years after the first Friday the 13th, as I remember, in the story. And you have a group of more camp counselors. But this is at another camp, which is just a walk away from Camp Crystal Lake. You know, it feels a lot like the first movie. I'm pretty sure they filmed it the same area, mm-hmm. Some sort of area. I think this was the beginning of the formula of the Friday the 13th films.
It was.
Where they knew they had to do the same thing because it was working, you know.
It was. You got to create the death scenes, and you know everything else revolves around that. That's pretty much what the formula was at this time.
Yeah. And you had Jason, who the beginning scene in the film is what I always remember better than anything.
Yeah.
Adrian King is brought back, who was the surviving heroine in the first film. And Jason comes to get her. Okay, she's killed in the opening scene, and I suppose Jason, the story they were going with was when Adrian King chopped Betsy Palmer's head off, Jason kept her head.
Yeah, okay. I guess he was really good at like
and
reading maps because he found her house too. I mean, and it was in the city, and I thought he was a mongoloid that really didn't leave the lake area, but.
No, Jason goes after him.
Yeah.
If he wants
him.
Yeah, so he stuffs her head in the fridge. I guess he wants to keep it fresh. So that was pretty cool.
There's 2 things that I remember about that movie the most. I just right off the top of my head that I can think of. Amy Steele is one of them.
Yeah.
Because she was a really good introduction to that
series.
The other, well, actually 3 things. The other one, the second one would be the guy in the wheelchair. And the way that...
Mark, did they call him Mark?
Yeah, I think so. And the machete to the face that he gets.
That was great, yeah.
Down the steps. And the last thing has always been the final scene in that movie where Amy Steele puts on Betsy Palmer's old sweater and her head's laying there in front of her. And she does the whole confused inbred Jason to make him think that she's his mother and all this stuff.
Yeah, and then you have another cameo from Betsy Palmer. It's in that movie. She just does like a little quick scene that is just what Jason envisions in his head, you know, that's Amy Steele's his mother or whatever, but sure enough, he sees the head behind Amy Steele, so he knows it's not her. I think he actually has like a pickaxe.
He slices
her leg with it. That's a cool scene, too. But this is a really killer film, and it's always one that I don't have a problem watching again. I'll just say that.
It gets a lot of flack from fans, though, because it doesn't really have the classic Jason, as in, i.e., he doesn't have the hockey mask yet. So I think that's pretty much why it gets... The tater sack didn't go over real well, I guess is what I'm saying.
Well, it's something different at the time, though, I suppose.
But the gore is really good, and actually the scenes, the death scenes, they're pretty standard for the series. It's just there's not much of anything else in that movie. But all in all, it's a good movie.
Good slasher. Mm-hmm. But right now, I suppose we should play the first part of the interview with Mr. Harry Manfredini, who gave us a great interview last night. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, wonderful, wonderful guy, and that was really great of him to take that much time out to do this.
Yeah, probably one of the best horror composers of our generation that I can think of.
Mm-hmm.
So here's the first part of the Harry Manfredini interview on DeadPit.com.
Hey, I just wanted to start off by asking you what exactly got you into music and what some of your early influences?
What actually got me into music?
Right.
Well, I guess... my mother and father were watching me when I was a little baby.
Yeah.
And I just sort of, I guess I had musical, sort of bent in that sort of direction. Even at early ages, I reacted to music really well. And I started taking lessons back when I was 6 or 7 years old.
Yeah.
And I had kind of interesting influence in that my father played nothing but Italian operas. So I had a huge hearing of that from the time I was little. And my brother was into contemporary jazz, which was like Stan Kenton and that sort of stuff. So those are the two influences I had. And people keep telling me they still hear it in my music. I go, okay, cool, fine. But I just always wanted to be in music. I'll tell you, since we don't have a lot of time, I could actually expand on this a little more. When I would play as a little kid, in my mind, I would score what I was playing musically. I just sort of heard music.
Yeah.
You know, sort of like, I mean, I loved films when I was a kid. I would stay up very late and watch movies, much to the chagrin of the nuns, the second grade nun teacher was going like, hey, he's late again today, watching some Bernard Herrmann film or something, you know.
Oh,
but what I'm saying is that it's very strange. When I was very young, I would dream that I was able to, this is obviously before I could even play much or anything, I dreamt that I was able to sit in a room, that I was going to be in a room where I would have this sort of magic keyboard, and there'd be a screen in front of me, a big screen, and the movie would come up on the screen, and then I could play at this magic keyboard, and it would come out whatever I wanted it to be. If it was, I wanted a trumpet, it would be a trumpet. If I wanted, you know, a flute, it would be a flute. If I wanted violin, it would be violin. And the scary thing is that's exactly where I am. I'm sitting in a room with a keyboard that literally can play any sound I want it to, looking at a screen. So be careful what you dream, Wes.
Now, we were reading on your site, you know, you had many years of training and going to school.
Yeah, I did. I ended up becoming, I studied keyboard and stuff like that, and then I started saxophone and clarinet when I was, like, in 7th or 8th grade. Got to the point where I was, you'll excuse the term, playing gigs when I was in high school. I was playing like 4 or 5 nights in high school, just playing gigs around Chicago, and got involved in records and playing on records and things like that. And then when I got out of high school, I sort of decided, well, I'm either going to become a math and science major or something like that, or I'm going into music. My father said, well, what do you want to do? And I said, Well, I said, I can always go back and do the math. Let's give music a try. And so I went into music, and I wasn't a composer yet. I never composed. I just loved music, you know, and wanted to learn more, and I learned, you know, a lot more. And then eventually started to teach for a few years. After I got my master's, I taught at Western Illinois University, and then I taught in Chicago for a while. And then went to get a doctorate at Columbia, and did all that work, did all those classes, and took my orals and everything. And then all at once, suddenly in New York, the record business and film business sort of opened up to me.
Yeah.
And I was really inspired. There was a teacher in New York named Don Fornuto who really opened me up as a writer. And for some reason or other, the fear of writing, which I had for a long time because I was never really sure of myself. People get, you know, when you listen to music and you hear people like Beethoven or anyone, Jerry Goldsmith or John Williams, pick anyone who's really good. That's pretty daunting when you hear that. You're like, wow, that's amazing. You know, I could never do that. And somehow or other, I lost my fear and said, what the hell, I'm just going to jump in there and do the best I can. And I did jingles, I did records, I did films, I did all sorts of stuff in New York for a very long time. And did a lot of children's films. I guess you looked on the website for that. If you have kids, you'll love some of these children's films I did. They're nonverbal, where the music literally has to tell the whole story. And there, a lot of them won, you know, big awards and things like that. And then somewhere along the line, I tripped over this film called Friday the 13th. And then I don't remember what happened after that.
Well, I guess...
Is that a good enough answer for that question?
That is a wonderful answer, and it threads right into the next question, which
go
is...
Go right ahead.
How did you come to meet Sean Cunningham?
Okay, I met Sean Cunningham. Well, let's just go back a couple. I was in New York just starting, and I met a guy who I was doing children's films for, these little short children's films. I did something called A Boy, A Dog, and a Frog. So it was like a 9-minute little film, just cute as can be. Mm-hmm. And I was doing like 3 or 4 films with him, and he said, hey, I know somebody in Connecticut who's doing a kid's film. And I said, well, great. He goes, you know, you'd do a great job. And I said, well, I sure would. Send me to this guy. And so I met this guy named Sean Cunningham and Steve Miner, who was his editor. And we did a film called Here Come the Tigers. It was a baseball, Little League baseball film, sort of basically a poor man's Bad News Bears.
Okay.
And we did that picture. And then we did another picture called Kick, which I think they changed the names to Manny's Orphans. And it was sort of the same movie, only it was about soccer. It was back in the late 70s when soccer was going to take over the United States, which, of course, it never has. But it was they had that soccer league in the United States. And so we put out this kids' soccer film, and it was fun. They were both cute little kids' films, and they were fine. Anyway, so one day I was over at Sean's, and these things, you know, as Sean always says, I had to put some food on the table, so I had to come up with something. So we were sitting there at the kitchen table one day, and he said to me, I'm going to make the scariest picture ever made, and it's going to be called Friday the 13th, and you're doing the music. And I said, well, okay, if you say so. And sure enough, he did it, and the rest, as they say, is history.
Well, I take it you were kind of excited doing that. You mentioned Bernard Herrmann before, and you're all...
Well, of course. I mean, you don't get into the film business unless you've tripped over Bernard Herrmann somewhere. I mean, he's affected and infected everyone's music. I mean, he's you know, one of the icons. I mean, you go back to, you know, Citizen Kane, and even before that, some incredible radio shows, The War of the Worlds, and so many great scores, and you can't help but be affected by that music. I mean, albeit that style is a little old today, it's still, people still are always, I mean, you don't have to listen very long to anyone to go like, it's kind of a Bernard Herrmann sort of thing there. And I mean, it's gotten to the point now where someone says, oh, gee, that's a Goldsmith kind of thing, or that's a Danny Elfman kind of thing, or worse yet, a Harry Manfredini kind of thing. But the reality is it's really a Bernard Herrmann kind of thing. And probably, if you really look at it, it's probably a Stravinsky or a Bartok kind of thing.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, let's face it, we all, we're listening to each other, and you learn. I listen to a lot of classical music, so I pick up a lot of techniques and ideas from that. So that's sort of the way that happens. I'll be honest with you, when you talk about Friday, I was never a big horror movie fan, and I wasn't really, the first time I saw that picture before the music was in it, and it was just a rough cut screening. There was no music at all. It was just the picture, the raw picture. Mm-hmm. And I was just like, who in the world is going to go see this? What in the world is this?
Yeah.
And, but things changed, didn't they?
Yeah.
You basically had the same response as Betsy Palmer did to the film, I think.
Well, Betsy, exactly, yeah. You know, I actually got to meet Betsy for the first time about a year ago at one of these convention things. And we actually went to we went to DePaul University, not at the mm-hmm. same time, but we both are from Chicago, and I was just so excited to meet her. What a great casting choice. You guys probably aren't old enough to remember Betsy Palmer, but Betsy Palmer was the sweetest, nicest person in the entire world. I mean, she had an aura, a sort of a connotation about her. I mean, if you looked up sweet, cute, nice, personable, happy, friendly, looked up all those words in the dictionary, there'd be a picture of Betsy Palmer.
Yeah.
And who to play the mad killer but Betsy Palmer? It was such an incredibly...
It actually angered a lot of her fans, from what I understand, before before the movie.
Oh yeah, I mean it's amazing. I mean it's just what a strange. I mean I can't even come up with anybody today who people think of as sweet and lovable as she was at that time. I mean I can't think of anybody today who would fill in for that kind of level of just a likable person, no one could think of a bad thing to say about her. She was just so sweet.
Was that maybe an angle for the film?
It might have been. It might have been. Someone just said, let's offer it to her. She could always. I think it was a pretty clever idea.
Yeah, it was.
There were a lot of brilliant things going on in that movie that always are kind of like put. People always say, well, yeah, that was that movie. I said, there was a lot more thinking going on in that movie than you think. And Victor Miller, the guy who wrote it, that's a much smarter script than you would think. And Sean, the way he directed it.
Yeah, Victor Miller, he's a really great television screenwriter, too.
He's a very good writer, and he's a really smart guy. And there's stuff in that movie that is deep that if you're not paying attention or if you don't really think about it, I'll give you one that just struck me the other day, and I bet you've probably thought of it, but I'll tell you something. You remember, everybody, of course, remembers Kevin Bacon.
Of course, yeah.
And the infamous Arrow, uh-huh. Right? Well, so what did Kevin Bacon just finish doing? Kevin Bacon was in love, right?
Mm-hmm.
What is the ultimate sign of somebody being in love?
Arrow through the heart.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. I've never actually thought of it that way.
It's really amazing, isn't it? There's some really cool stuff. And the great thing about that scene is the way it's shot, how there's a kid in the upper bunk. There's something bad happening. He's there. All at once, the blood comes from above. So the whole concentration of the whole scene, visually, is from above. And yet, when that hand comes out from underneath the bed and grabs him, and then, of course, the arrow, I mean, it's such a brilliantly misdirected shot, and then, of course, like I said, the sub the subtext of The Arrow Through the Heart, which I just cracked up. I can't believe that. So, I mean, there were some really, really clever things.
I was curious about, you know, scenes like that especially. You know, directors usually storyboard out scenes like that. I was wondering, do you do that with the music as well?
I'll tell you what we did. There were conscious things that we did with the music that we didn't do subsequently, but in that picture we did. And if you have some time someday, go back and watch it, and I'll tell you what they are. First of all, I like to think of that score as sort of myopic. That whole film is myopic. It's not about anything else than exactly what it is. It isn't trying to do anything other than exactly what it does. It isn't making any, you know, political statements or anything other than that. It's just exactly what it is. You know, it's a one-track, one-trick pony sort of thing. But the thing about the music in that picture is that the music only exists when something, when the stalker is there. It doesn't play anything else other than that.
Right.
And the thing about that movie is that in that picture, you don't know who the killer is. That's totally different from a Jason movie, where it's Jason. You know, what's the surprise? There is no surprise. It's Jason. You know, he's a killing machine. He's a shark. You know, but here it's like it seems as though there's somebody there who you never see. You know, it's just totally, you know. So, I had to create a character, a musical character, that became the person who actually the audience was, because it was POV of the killer. So the audience had to become, you know, had to feel that, uh-oh, this is the bad person. Now, so I had to identify that person musically. Otherwise, you know, let's face it, it's all POV of the camera. It's like, you know, so when was there going to be something going to happen, and when was it just something else? And I can give you a couple examples of what I mean.
Okay.
One, in that picture, there's a scene where one girl is setting up the archery thing.
Uh-huh.
And she's putting up the, you know, the target, you know, the big thing full of straw, whatever, I forget what they call it. Anyway, and suddenly an arrow just like whew, comes bang, you know, right into the target.
Yeah.
And scares the hell out of her. In 99% of every other movie that you ever see, there would be a musical sting and there would be something happening.
Mm-hmm.
Totally left alone.
Hmm.
There was no music there.
I think
there isn't any music. There's a scene early on in the film where Adrian King's character and the guy who's the sort of the camp owner, I think his name is Chris, for some reason I can't remember, but the guy with the glasses, the curly hair guy, he's the camp owner who's going to reopen the camp. There's a scene there where he's fixing a storm drain, or not a storm drain, a drain, you know, on the side of the cabin.
Whatever.
Yeah, gutter, yeah. And so for some reason or other, you get the feeling that there was some sort of relationship between the two of them at one time.
Yeah.
And it's sort of gone sour.
Mm-hmm.
But he touches her face, and there's a feeling there. Any other film, there would have been some warm, sentimental music to sort of underline that relationship. There was no music. So we made a conscious effort to only put the music where the killer was, if it was going to be a kill or something like that. So it was a very conscious effort about the music.
Yeah, I was watching the film.
With the exception of the ending, of course, where we...
Yeah, that's what I was going to bring up.
We fooled everybody.
You had the placid music, you thought everything...
Right.
Yeah.
No, that was a trick. That was a cool trick, too. I don't know how much you know about that music. Do you want me to go on with that?
Oh, that's fine, whatever you want.
Oh, okay. early on in the movie, in fact, the very first, very first scene in the movie,
right,
where the girl comes to the diner to get a ride to camp,
mm-hmm,
cute little girl, Robbie Morgan, her name is, she goes into this diner, which is a pretty scary place to begin with, but on the radio is playing this song, okay?
Yeah.
And what happens is on the radio that song was there. When I first saw the movie, they had a piece of, you know, temp source music, and it was a Dolly Parton tune called Fly Away Little Bluebird, I think is what the name of it was.
Yeah.
It's a Dolly Parton tune. So, we got to replace that because we certainly can't afford to buy that. So I sit down and I say, I'm going to write a song like that, and it's going to be called Sail Away, Tiny Sparrow. Okay? So, because it was Fly Away, Little Bluebird,
Here's
a fly, sail, sparrow, bluebird. Okay. So I write this thing called Sail Away, Tiny Sparrow, and it's a country song about a girl whose marriage has gone down the tubes, and she's leaving, and she's on her way out. So that's what it was about. So I wrote this song, and I said, cool. So we put it there. And subsequently, later on in the movie, when it's raining, the camp owner goes back to that diner to have a coffee or something in the rain and everything. And sure enough, that song's playing on the radio again. It's evidently, it must be a hit. It played twice in the movie. But if you listen closely, the music that plays at the end of the film, what you call the Placid Lake, Placid music, is actually sort of a instrumental version of that tune. Never thinking that Sail Away, Tiny Sparrow, she's in a boat on a lake. Anyway, so I never thought that that was going to actually work. But the cool thing about that scene is that Bill Frieda, who was the editor, he cut that exceptionally long. I mean, we had that concept, but I says, I've got to play something here. Well, you know, we sat with Son. I said, I've got to play something here that says, this movie's over. Put your coat on, Mabel. We're leaving. You know, this movie is over. That was fun. Yeah, that was really cool. You know, we saw the head chopped off. It was great.
Yeah, I'd heard there was a lot of people that left before they saw that scene. They thought it was
well,
over.
People were starting to, you know, rustle in the seats, at least, you know, putting the popcorn down, you know, getting their stuff together and things like that. And he cut it exceptionally long. You know, there's a funny thing about being scared, and that's about the idea of what you expect. And at a certain point there, the time just got to be too long that you didn't expect it anymore. You know what I'm saying? Like, if anything was going to happen, it would have happened by now, you know? And the police were on the shore, and it was going, and she's there, and she's playing in the water. And it just went long enough so that when he came out of the lake, I mean, people went flying in the audience. I mean, Sean and I went to a couple of screenings, test screenings, and we used to sit in the front row. And just whatever any scare, whatever it happened to be, whether it was Kevin Bacon or that one, we would just slip ourselves down in the front row and slide so like no one could see us. And then we would turn around and go back, and instead of watching the screen, we'd be watching the audience.
Yeah.
And I kid you not, in that last scene, there was like popcorn flying in the air and people jumping out of seats and screaming. And you know, I mean, it was amazing the reaction that got, you know.
That's truly one of the most memorable scenes in horror films. And
it sure is.
And
sure
the setup with the music does actually make it even more memorable now that I think about it.
Well, exactly. That's exactly. I mean, like I said, the whole thing about it is that I made it feel like, oh, it's a dream. It's over. Or, you know, you expected those, you know, the credit roll to come up from the bottom of the screen at any second. And it was just the right amount. It was a combination of cutting, music, timing, shooting. The whole
together. How long did it take you to write the score for the film?
That score?
Uh-huh.
Ooh. Let's see. You're talking a long time ago.
I was reading in the book, though, that you did most of it just by yourself.
Oh, yeah. I did most of it by myself, yeah.
That's amazing.
Right. Well, thank you. I would say 2-3 weeks.
That is truly amazing. I have to say.
Well, no, I've done. I mean, I don't know if you guys have you seen this movie, The Omega Code.
Uh-huh.
Well, I did that one in 2 weeks too.
Uh-huh.
So take a listen to that sometime. It's a lot more involved than Friday the 13th.
You worked with many, many directors, and a few of them are like, you know, Wes Craven, Steve Miner.
Right, Wes, yeah.
I was wondering, do directors usually give you a general idea of the kind of sound they want, or you have, like, free reign to do?
Yes and no. Wes, for the most part, doesn't say a lot about what he wanted. You know, certainly knows. Wes is a very funny guy, by the way. If you ever get to interview him, he's got a great sense of humor. Someday he should just do comedies because he's really, really funny. Steve, on the other hand, has ideas, which are fine with me, like I did a movie called House. Actually one of my favorites, too. Well, thank you. And he said to me, oh, we're doing this picture, House. I said, okay, where he says. He says, here's what I want. And I said, what? He says, I want a cello.
That's what we're talking about.
He says, I want a cello. And I said, I'll tell you what, Steve. I'll give you a cello. I said, it's an excellent idea. I said, if you can tell me what a cello is. Because there are stories and stories and stories. Excuse me, I'll take a drink.
Okay.
It's water, by the way. There are stories and stories and stories about, you know, people say, well, I think I'd like this, and then they have no idea what they're even talking about. So I said to Steve, I said, if you could tell me what a cello is, I said, it's a really good idea, and I said, I think I would love to use it. I said, but you got to tell me what a cello is. He says, that's that thing that the girl has between her legs and she rubs it. I said, that's exactly a cello. So I said, absolutely, you're going to get a cello. So you get that, and the opening credits there with the cellos. I had two cellos and two French horns and a bunch of synths, and it was sort of a...
After I heard that, I was actually going to ask you if you had been trained in cello, but I guess you answered that question.
No, I've never. It's one of my favorite instruments. I love cello very, very much. But it was really quite effective. It was sort of interesting. There was a whole... and what I tried to do is take that and use it in very, various places, that particular instrumentation, the two cellos, two French horns, and then me filling in the rest of the sounds with synths and things. So I used it a lot throughout the picture, so it was kind of fun. It was I like that kind of stuff. I mean, I try to come up with a color for every picture I do that is peculiar, I guess would be the word, to that particular picture.
What a great... That's the first part of that interview, by the way.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And you can hear him explain a lot more things about the film and the making of the k-k-k sound. In case you don't know, he explains it in great detail in the second part of the interview, which will be later on in the show. This will probably be hour three or whatever we're on. I have no idea what we're going to do. But, you know, we didn't go into great planning stages on this. We just did this because...
We love horror movies.
Yeah,
it's Friday the 13th. What do you want, bitches?
It's our tribute to the greatest horror franchise going. So,
enough said.
Part
three.
Here's one we talked
3D,
to.
3D, by the way.
We talked to Paul Kraka yesterday.
Played Rick in part three.
Which is another cool interview. We're going to play that here in a minute, too. This movie is always one of my favorite films, horror films, period. It's probably the classic characters that's in this movie is you've got the Cheech and Chong guy, the Tommy Chong dude. You've got Shelley, who's one of the best characters in the throughout the whole series.
Larry's Erner.
And then you've got the introduction of the hockey mask.
Mm-hmm. Which... a lot of people know this, but it was actually a prop that Shelley in the movie used to scare people. He was kind of like the jokester, and he had all kinds of masks mm-hmm. and stuff, and he ends up having the hockey mask, and he ends up getting killed, and Jason takes the mask, and there's the introduction of the hockey mask.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, too, I'm pretty sure that part three is voted the most favorite.
We have
on the site.
Yeah, we have a poll up on the
site. We can go over that while we're at it. Which it sort of surprised me that part three was actually the favorite throughout of the whole series. I don't know, for some reason I thought part seven would be the most popular. Part six,
the original one, you would think.
I mean, a lot of the younger fans, you know, even us, really, we grew up with six, five, six, seven, eight, like that. I thought that would be more popular, but I'll go right down the ladder right here. Friday the 13th, the original was 17%. Friday the 13th Part 2 got 9%. Part 3 got a whopping 30%, which is the most popular as it stands right now. Friday the 13th Part 4 at 17%. And then you have a three-way tie for 5, 6, and 7, which is all at 9%. Now, the key thing here, we've not talked about these films yet, but Part 8 through Freddy vs. Jason all didn't receive a vote.
Yeah, this is, you know, by no means a probably statistically accurate poll, but no. If you ask most people, and I've seen like a poll that had a lot more numbers than this of people that voted, Part 3 seems to be the overriding favorite film. I don't know why that is, but...
It kind of surprised me, but Part 3 is a good film anyway. Who cares? Some more favorite things in Part 3 that I always liked is Harold and I think Edna. In the very beginning. I always remember as a kid, I was like, what the hell? He's eating. All right. First he gets peanuts. He eats peanuts, right?
Yeah.
Then he goes and drinks orange juice. Then after that, he gets like a chocolate donut. Okay, that's the oddest array of... Who the hell would eat like that?
I think it was just a big setup for him to go in the bathroom so he could get, like, killed in there later.
I have no idea.
But that
was always something. I don't know.
I always thought that the snake that jumps out of him looked so crappy in that film where they had it set up in 3D.
That was one of the 3D settings. Yeah. That's another thing, too, man. The 3D, I've never seen the film in 3D.
We talked to Paul Crack about that, too.
Yeah, we mentioned that, too.
And by the way, if you don't listen to the interview, at least you should know that there is possibly a DVD circulating of Part 3 in 3D.
Yeah, I think he's eBay. I think he said it got on eBay. The thing about that is, though, you know the regular red and blue 3D glasses that was used later on? You have to use a special... Yeah, I think it's earlier 3D glasses. They're called shutter glasses that you have to use, and those are like $100.
Yeah, so you're gonna have a pretty expensive time trying to watch this.
I'd love 3D. To see it, but I don't want to spend that kind of money on it, you know.
But out of all the movies,
but I want to mention though too, Steve Miner directed part two and part three. Mm-hmm. So,
and Steve Miner directed a lot of good horror films. He directed The House, and he directed most of a couple of the Friday the 13th movie.
He did Halloween H2O, too. Mm-hmm. And he's going to do the Day of the Dead remake here next year, I think. But anyway, another one of the things I enjoyed in Part 3 was, and I mentioned it to him, was the head-crushing, eye-popping death scene of Paul Crack, who played Rick. We talked to him about that, and you'll hear that here in a minute. So, Part 3, it's definitely the fan's favorite, at least on our website.
I think that a lot of people really like Jason in that movie, too. The way that Richard Brooker
He did a really good job playing Jason. The walk he did is the thing I always remember.
Yeah.
So we're on to Part 4, which is another one that... The fans enjoy. I mean, it's always one that's up there among the best ones.
One thing you can understand about the movies that did really well on that poll... is that they all had really some kind of shocking ending that you can remember to this day.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Part 2 had the Amy Steele, you know, imitates Betsy Palmer thing. And, you know, Part 3 had Jason coming back to life.
Yeah, actually going back to Part 2, if you remember at the end, the inbred Warrington Gillette just grabbed.
Yeah, that's comes through the window,
scare.
Too.
Yeah.
But Part 4, the thing I remember most about that movie has to be the ending. I mean... because it was you know, it's Corey Feldman's in this movie. And you got to keep in mind that this was around the same time he was doing Goonies and...
No, it's a little bit before that.
Well, okay, yeah, but it'd be around the...
He was around... I think he was doing Gremlins around this time.
Okay. But if you don't remember the end of the movie, he shaves his head completely bald.
Yeah.
And tries to trick Jason into thinking that he's the younger Jason.
Right.
And just that scene of itself is worth watching this movie.
Yeah.
But you got Savini back doing the makeup on this film, by the way.
And that's one of the coolest things, uh-huh. Like the skewering of the head when he falls down on the machete.
Yep.
That was one of Savini's best effects, in my opinion. Ted White actually played Jason in this, and I think he was an old guy then. He was... He was in his 50s?
Yeah, he was in his late 50s or late maybe 40s.
Yeah, I don't know. He was an old guy then. I remember seeing pictures of the film when it came out. And he's probably the most elusive of all the Jasons, because most of them do conventions and stuff like that. They're easy to find. What's your opinion on him as Jason, really?
Not nearly as memorable as Richard Brooker, I don't think.
Yeah.
And actually not...
He's actually, you can't really remember, I don't remember much about.
No, that's what I was thinking. I can't think of him specifically in that movie. I can think of certain scenes that had to do with makeup and stuff. I can't think of really what his character was like. Now, yeah. You get into the Kane Hodder stuff later on, you know, he had a real distinct persona that he created, and actually Richard Brooker did too. But I don't know, not one of the better Jasons in my opinion.
Another funny thing about this movie too is Crispin Glover is actually in it, and he's got a cool death scene in the film too.
Yeah,
with the corkscrew to the eye or whatever. Yeah, but that's part four.
And once we start getting into these sequels, it's really no point talking about a plot or anything, because you basically know what the plot is.
It's the same sort of stuff.
We're just going to talk about the scenes we can remember the most, and you know.
But now I guess we'll play the Paul Kratky interview for part three. It's a really cool interview, and you know, we'll be back in about 20. To talk about some more of the films. So stick around on deadpit.com Friday the 13th.
Just wanted to ask you a couple of basic questions about how you got involved with acting and stuff.
You betcha.
I know you were friends with Tracy Savage from the film.
Right.
Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Well, her mother, Judy Savage, is an agent. And at the time... she was my agent, and a buddy of mine that I was studying acting with,
mm-hmm.
a guy named Harris Cowell, who'd done quite a bit of work on Happy Days, a TV show with Ron Howard and Henry Winkler. Anyway, make a long story short, he'd been on an interview, a casting call, and said, yeah, go meet these casting people, and so, anyway, Tracy Savage was just a girl that was, her mom was my agent, and so that's how I knew her.
Oh, okay. I was wondering, did you do any type of theater or anything before you got into film?
Yeah, I sure did. I did theater at Santa Monica City College, and then started doing some, you know, commercials and on-camera spokesman and things like that.
Did you have to audition for the role of Rick in Friday the 13th, Part 3?
Quite a bit, actually. I went, like I said, my friend Harris said, oh, Paul, you got to go meet these casting directors. They're really, really nice guys. And so I went in and met them. And they, you know, I went in for the same role that my friend had gone in to read for. And the casting director said, no, you're not right for that role, but you're really... right for the role of the lead. Can you come back in a couple days and read for the director and the producer? That was Steve Miner and Frank Mancuso Jr. Mm-hmm. And so I went back and I read, and that was a good story, because when I left the first day, they said, look at this character you're coming back for, Rick. You know, he's a carpenter, he lives up in the hills, so, you know, don't come dressed here in nice clothes, you know. Try and, you know, make it look a little bit more like the character. So I showed up for the second interview for the director, and the producer, and I was wearing blue jeans and work boots and a parka, and then I carried in a couple of 2x4s on my shoulder and a skill saw in my hand.
Uh-huh.
And they just ate that up. They thought that was the greatest thing. So anyway, you know, soon afterwards I had an idea that they were very interested in me. But, you know, in that business, until you sign the contract, it's not really a done deal. So I kept reading, and because they were really having a tough time finding a girl to play the lead, you know, and because Amy Steele from Part 2 was unavailable, and, you know, this gal, Dana Kimmel, that they ended up hiring, she was unavailable at the time, and so they had me read for probably 2 months. I kept reading, you know, once or twice a week I would go and read with these people, these different actresses, and they would do screen tests and all this. So I had a good idea that I was their guy because they wouldn't have had me keep reading as they were looking for actresses.
Yeah, they're
but it went on for a couple of months. It was pretty nerve-wracking.
Yeah, they pretty much had you trying to find the other actresses' parts, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. One thing I've really been curious about is, have you ever seen the film in 3D?
Oh yeah, numerous times.
What did you think about the whole film, but basically the eye-popping scene?
We've actually never seen it in 3D. I was wondering if there's a DVD, you know, if you know of any DVD that might be out there in the works.
Well, you know, when I was back in New York recently promoting that film, the day they came back, the most recent thing I just did, a guy came up to me, and he said that he found on eBay a DVD that he bought that when you watch it on your TV with the right glasses, the 3D glasses, that you can see it in 3D. So, yes. Now, I'd love to get a copy of that myself and have that just for, you know, my own posterity. But, yeah, if you guys haven't seen it in 3D, man, it's just awesome. It makes the whole thing really, really fun.
Yeah, I would absolutely love to see that in 3D one day. But what did you think about your scene, your death scene, especially? In 3D?
Well, it was awesome. I mean, the first time I saw the movie all the way through at the screening when the studio called us all in when they finished the movie, I just loved, you know, from the opening credits with the music, they come out like partway off the screen,
mm-hmm.
and then there's a couple beats, and then they come out all the way out, you know, even further, and then the theater, that was just intense because it came out like halfway into the audience, and then when it came out the rest of the way, it came to the credits were actually, you know, holographically right between you and the person sitting in front of you. It was really a trip. And then my particular scene, I thought it was awesome. It was fun to watch.
They had to make a mold of your face with that too, didn't they? How was that?
Yeah, actually, a couple months before we started filming, I went to this special effects lab in North Hollywood, and it was really an interesting experience. What they did was they made an upper body cast, so from like my chest up, they put all this plaster of Paris, this, you know, plaster material, and then they went up over the back of my head and the side of my head, and then at the last bit, they covered my face. And all they had were these two little straws sticking out of my nose to breathe. And then they waited for it to dry, and then they pulled the straws out and said, okay, this is what's going to happen, Paul. You're going to have to kind of wiggle your face around to free it up from the mold. And when I did that, the two little air holes that I was breathing through my nose, they moved. And all of a sudden, I was like, oh, my God, they better cut this thing off me quickly. And they were. They knew this was the routine, and they cut it off really quickly because I was starting to get a little panic there. But, yeah, they created this whole upper body mold, and they made a reverse mold of that and made this mannequin thing of me. And when we actually went out to film that scene during that period, you know, so now there's been a couple months have gone by now, and I forgot all about that thing that they made that and blah, blah. And so, you know, we're filming it 2-3 months later, and we're filming at night at this point. We're filming from like 7 at night till 7 in the morning, and it's about 3 in the morning, and we're getting ready to shoot that scene. And they wheel this thing out on a cart, and it's like this upper body replica of me, and it was just amazing to see.
ABC. I mean, well, it's 3 in the morning, it's dark, we're out in the mountains, you know, shooting this horror film, and they bring this thing out. It was very eerie because it looked exactly like me.
I'd say it was a bit surreal to have to see, you know, your upper body wheeled out in front of you.
I know, it was. It was really amazing, and they made it out of this kind of latex flesh-like material with these collapsible plates inside of it so they could do multiple takes of the head crushing and the eye popping out.
Yeah, that's actually one of my favorite scenes ever in Friday the 13th.
You're very kind.
I was curious, what made you decide to give up acting and pursue chiropractic?
Well, after I did that movie, I made the mistake of changing agents. And the agent that I went to, he felt because I'd done the leading role in this film that I should, like, take this next big quantum leap. And so he was putting me out, having me read against some pretty big names at the time, like Christopher Walken and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, doing that Friday the 13th was a very nice accomplishment or addition to my resume, if you will, but we should have probably, you know, taken kind of the next baby step, if you will, instead of just go for the home run. So anyway, I was getting a little frustrated, and also, in addition to doing that movie, I'd done a couple big commercials, and so I actually was able to support myself. I didn't need to work a regular job, so to speak, and so I went back to school with the idea that, you know, maybe I'd go, you know, get a degree in biology because I didn't know if I wanted to dedicate my life or my career, if you will, my professional career, to something that was so unpredictable. You know, there's some very, very good actors.
There's not a lot of job security in that.
You can be good and still languish in poverty your entire career. I mean, literally, there's people that are, you know, 40, 50, 60 years old that are just scraping by or have their entire careers, and that doesn't mean they're bad or they don't have talent. It just, you're right, the competition is so stiff. So anyway, I was a little nervous about that, and so I went back to school because I had the time and the money to do it, and one thing led to another, and I ended up in chiropractic school.
Okay. You recently participated in the Friday the 13th 25th anniversary, didn't you?
Yes.
How was that, meeting all those other people, you know, and reuniting with the Part 3 group?
Well, you know, there was only the only Part 3 person that was there that night was Larry Zerner, who I've stayed in contact with. As far as the people from the other movies, you know, I don't know any of them, I really enjoyed, that was the one you're talking about where they did that book release?
Yeah, I believe so.
Yeah, up in Universal Studios.
Yeah.
The thing that was really exciting for me was to see Peter Brackey's book.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, one, the guy's just the nicest guy, and he's the one that did that, moderated the commentary that we did before they released that DVD box set.
Right.
You know, we put an audio commentary on Part 3, and anyway, Peter was the one that moderated that. So I got to know him, really nice guy. And so he said he was doing this book, you know, and so a couple of years back he interviewed me over the phone about the book and this and that, and so I stayed in contact with him, and then he said he was having this launch party for this book to coincide with the 25th anniversary.
Yeah.
Well, have you seen this book?
Yeah, I actually have. It's an unbelievable book.
It is unbelievable. I mean, I'm not the biggest horror fan in the world, and you know, Friday the 13th, you know, I'm just happy to be a part of it and very proud to be a part of it, but it's not, you know, I'm not one of these, you know, diehard horror fans like a lot of your listeners are, but I was so impressed with the book. I mean, it's just such a huge, beautiful, like, coffee table. I mean, it's just a really incredible piece of work.
He put a lot of effort into the detail of it, I think, too.
He worked on that for quite some time, man. He's a very thorough man. And so when I walked into that reunion, and there was his book sitting there, and I had to sign like 200 copies that night, so that took me like 35 minutes straight of nonstop. But I walked in and looked at the book, and I was just, my jaw literally just dropped. I went, oh my gosh, Peter, this is just amazing. You know, congratulations. What a beautiful piece of work. It was just, and sitting on my coffee table. I think it's just beautiful.
Yeah, that one.
I was going to ask, I think it's, speaking of Larry Zerner, I think it's the new film that you've got coming out called Daniel's Revenge.
Right.
Isn't your name Professor Lawrence Zerner in that movie?
That's right. Well, that movie hasn't been made yet, and it's still kind of in the planning stages. I hope it happens, because it sounds like a great story.
I was just curious about how that came about.
What's that?
I was just curious about how that name came about for the character.
Well, Scott Goldberg, who's the director, he's the one that directed The Day They Came Back, the movie that just...
The zombie movie?
What's that?
Is that the zombie movie?
Yeah.
Okay.
He's a huge horror fan, and he just loves Friday the 13th. So in that movie, The Day They Came Back, my character's name was Jason, Detective, what was the last name? Jason something or other. Anyway, and so he likes to pay homage or pay honor to the Friday the 13th. So he named that character in that movie, and then this one coming up called Daniel's Revenge, he's going to name me after Larry Zerner.
I think that's feeding somehow.
Yeah, it is.
Dust to Dust was another movie that you've got these coming out back-to-back, I think. That one's got some pretty amazing cast in it, with Linnea Quigley and Joe Estevez. And
yeah, I hope that comes to be. I mean, you know, what's interesting with the Internet now is these directors, you know, they really start hyping all this stuff. And, you know, we haven't filmed that yet, too. So I really hope it happens. I have confidence it will. I just got an email the other day that they're kind of getting the schedule worked out, so they'll let me know when I'm supposed to be filming. But, you know, I sure hope that comes to be. But, yeah, that's going to be really exciting if that comes to be. I'd love to work with Joe Estevez. That would be amazing.
Mm-hmm. The way that's set up, too, from the looks of what I've been able to read about it, is it would be like a type of a segment, like a creep show type of horror movie.
Yeah, exactly.
There would be like several different stories. Do you know what your story is? Have you gotten a script or anything?
I've gotten this script, and I've read it through one time, and it's a great story. I won't... it's basically about a couple guys that are sitting in a pool hall, and they overhear this guy whining about something that he got ripped off by some old woman that fired him, and blah blah blah. And they start talking to this guy and give him a few more beers, and they find out that she's got a safe down in her basement just packed with cash because she doesn't believe in banks. So me and this other guy decide that we're going to talk this guy into ripping her off to get revenge on her. And and then in the basement is this other thing that I won't spoil the story, but it's pretty cool. So, yeah, I'm really looking forward to it. I'm just so flattered and honored that these young directors would like me to be part of their projects. I'm just really excited. I'm really looking forward to it.
I guess that goes into my other question, too. Did Scott Goldberg seek you out?
Yeah, he did.
Okay.
Yeah.
How did that come about, the relationship?
Well, he, I probably, not a week goes by that I don't get an email or a fan letter from somebody from around the world. They come from all over the place, you know. And, you know, the horror fans are just the best people, man. They are the sweetest, kindest, most appreciative people. And so I always, you know, answer every email, and, you know, people send me stuff to autograph, I always do it, things like that. And anyway, so I get an email from this person, Scott Goldberg, and he says, you know, he's a Friday the 13th fan and blah, 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 and this and that. And he said he's also an independent filmmaker who just recently graduated from film school in New York. And he goes, would you ever consider being in one of my movies? And I'm thinking, yeah, right, this is a bunch of BS, you know. And so I just politely said, yeah, whatever, you know. Just kind of blew it off and didn't think anything else of it. And then about 6 or 9 months goes by, and I get another email from him saying, he says, okay, we got a shooting schedule put together and just want to make sure you're on board and you want to do this. So I thought, oh, man, I better check this guy out, see if he's for real. And so I did, and he seemed like he was a nice guy and had a couple phone conversations with him. And he said, you know, he goes, look, man, I really can't pay you, but, you know, I can pay for your flight and this and that. And so I flew back to Long Island, and, you know, they accommodated my schedule. It was really nice. And ends up, you know, Scott and I now have become good friends, and he's just a – he's a really, really nice guy. I mean, he looks like a freak, but he's a really, really nice guy.
We really appreciate you doing this interview and everything, but I was just, to end the conversation, I guess we could ask, do you have any more plans for the future, any more movies coming up that you want to mention?
Just the ones that you already mentioned, and, you know, I'm sure some of your fans or whatever are, you know, possibly, you know, up-and-coming filmmakers themselves, and, you know, I always feel an incredible loyalty to the horror fans, and so I'm more than willing to help out on projects if I can, and if it works out. So, other than that, no, and thank you very much for your interest in me and this whole situation.
Well, I can't tell you how much I appreciate this personally, and I thank you a lot.
Oh, you're very welcome. Anytime, email me if you have anything, and anything coming up, and you guys should put together in your town like a 3D film festival. Go to your local independent theater, and they could put together a 3D film festival, and, you know, it'd show Friday the 13th and Jaws 3D and Amityville Horror 3D, and you know, because they did that once in Santa Monica a few years ago, and it was so much fun. I went there with Larry Zerner and Richard Brooker, and it was done on a Friday the 13th weekend, kind of like this one coming up this weekend. And we went up there on a Friday night and kicked off the movie and opened it for them, and it was really a lot of fun. So maybe you guys could do that at your local theater.
Well, if I could get a midnight movie going at our local theater, I'd be happy with that.
Yeah. You guys are in Kentucky, is that correct?
Yeah, we are.
All right.
There's not much going on here as far as horror movies go, so we're pretty much the only, you know.
Well, in our little area of Eastern Kentucky, we are one of the very few people that do a horror show or anything.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's a pretty heavy kind of Bible Belt area.
It is.
Definitely. Yeah, it's too bad that they, you know, frown on that, because it is just, you know, as you and I both know, it's very innocent entertainment.
Yeah.
But it's unfortunately not perceived that way, and it's too bad because, I mean, I'm a Christian myself, and I just don't agree with that kind of painting everybody with the same brush. Is that just because someone likes a particular type of genre of movie? It's like people, I'm sure there's people that read murder mysteries or whatever, and that doesn't, you know, and that's too bad, because you guys you should have a midnight horror film night there, like once a month or something. That would be great.
Yeah, we think that would be a good idea, personally, but
it's only going to happen at our house. But we really appreciate you doing the interview and everything.
Oh, you're very welcome.
We wish you best luck in everything you do, whatever.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks, Mr. Kraken.
Oh, you're welcome. Bye-bye.
All right. That was the interview with Paul Kraken. And if you want to check out his site, you can email him and ask, you know, send something for autograph or something if you want to. It's healthyfamilycairo.com. So you can check that out. We're on to my personal favorite, and I know, like, there's only two people that voted for this film as their favorite, and we're both talking on here right now.
Mm-hmm.
My favorite was A New Beginning, which is part 5. And to me, everything essential in a slasher movie was in this movie, and a lot of it was.
In spades. What do you think of when you think about slasher movies? You think of what? Nudity?
Plenty of that.
You think of gore?
Ton of that.
You think of really interesting or bad characters or overblown characters?
Let's see, you got Ethel, Junior, Demon. That's all you need.
Reggie?
You know, you got Reggie? You got them all. I mean,
just for the, I'll come on, just for the,
let me tell you something. Demon and those damn enchiladas. That's a classic horror. I mean, that's what I love about horror movies, is characters like that.
And you, come on now.
Are really there just for, you know, comedic purposes, I suppose?
Yeah, they know they're going to get mowed down very shortly. So they just kind of entertain you up to the point where they get killed.
Like the opening scene where you see Ethel. Okay? I love that. I've seen that probably, you know, probably 100 times. I mean, it never gets old. Like some of those lines, I would love to talk to her, by the way. If you know of anybody that could get me in contact with Carol Logato, who played Ethel, I would love to talk to her. But, you know, she did a really great job in that role. You know, I don't know, you know, what kind of character development she was going for with that, if she knew somebody that acted like that. But you really thought that she was that character. I mean, you know.
Yeah, there was no, like, pretension behind that performance at all. And you, how could you not like scenes like the one with Junior, where he's riding around on the dirt bike?
Yeah.
You know, screaming, "He hurt me, Mama!
Get in here, Junior, and eat your goddamn slop!
He hurt me bad!" Seriously, I mean, that's classic stuff. And then, the, you know, the machete to the head.
Another favorite in the film, too, and she's one that you don't really see nude, actually, but she's the favorite, is the Tiffany Helm, who played Violet.
Yeah,
she's got like a cult following on the internet. I'm sure that probably freaks her out.
I'm thinking just because for the you know, walk like an Egyptian dance that she does in the film, she got some kind of weird Euro.
And she had the
Euro
early goth look, I guess is what you call it. But one of my favorite scenes is the Debbie Sue Voorhees scene.
Mm-hmm.
After they get done, you know, taking care of their
business, if you will.
Yeah. First, you see the guy, I can't even remember the character's name, the guy that bones her, I guess is what you said.
I think it was Rick or something like that. I mean, first
you see,
Rick
you see him, this is creative destiny too, with Jason has like a belt, and he wraps it around his head, then he like has that around a stick and tightens it on the tree, and it basically like, I don't know, until it breaks the belt, and it basically fucks that guy up, flat out.
Mm-hmm.
Then you go on to Debbie Sue, who laying there in all of her nude glory, right?
And that was something.
And that was pre fake titties, or at least before fake titties got popular enough.
It was.
That was genuine.
Breasticles?
Yeah. I mean, that was genuine, you could tell. And, you know, she gets like hedge clippers to the face or to the eyes or something like that. But the film, to me, has everything. And I know the people always complain, I guess the general thing in the movie that usually gets talked about is, oh, it's not Jason. Let me tell you something, folks. Let me tell you something. It's never Jason. It's an actor playing Jason. It's somebody with a hockey mask on, okay? That doesn't matter.
Yeah, I mean, if you get somebody about 6'5" that's pretty burly, they can play Jason. I'm sorry to tell all these people this, but it really doesn't take that much consideration.
I'm not even talking about that. I'm just saying, the complaint is, it's not Jason, it's Roy, right? Anybody could be, it's a shape, really. It's kind of like they call Michael Myers the shape. It's the killer, okay? That doesn't matter. But let's go on. You can tell it's our favorite because we've talked about it the most. All right. We're on to another favorite of the series, which is part 6, which was the first one I ever saw. I don't know about you.
First one I saw was probably part 7.
I remember renting this. This is probably one of the first, I think it was the first horror movie I ever rented for video.
A couple of things about this movie, about part 6, that keep in mind. It does have Tom Matthews in it, who was from Return of the Living Dead. I don't know if a lot of people have seen that, but
I'm guessing a lot of people have.
Uh-huh. And a lot of things about this movie that are really good. I think it has Horseshack in the beginning of it, too,
yeah,
if I'm not mistaken. But this is one of the first movies where they actually supposedly have killed Jason, and then they revive him somehow.
Yeah, I think this was really when the Jason movies were kind of getting... They were trying to be hokey at the same time. Like, I think this one had the James Bond opening, you know, with the where they have Jason in the hockey mask guy and stuff like that. Do you remember that?
Yeah, it was where he was walking across the screen and he turns around.
Slashes with a machete and it plays the music.
It was...
And I really, yeah, it was... I always loved the beginning scene, too, where Jason... It's... All right, I hate to be sort of graphic here, but this is what, like, Uncle Bill and I usually call Slug Dick Jason. Okay? Mm-hmm. This is the debut of Slug Dick Jason, which is the zombie Jason, which, you know, that's the best way to describe him. Because I'm not sure many people think about, like, Jason's genitalia or whatever, but I'm always... assuming it would look like a slug, you know, the way he looked in the movie.
Yeah. They did a really good job in the makeup, though. I mean, I'm not sure who did the makeup for that film. But,
me either, really.
But the zombie Jason in that movie looks pretty convincing.
Yeah. I mean, it's a... it has a lot of, like, not creative death scenes and things like
not
that.
Not the best zombie Jason. That'll be coming up here in a second.
Yeah.
But... the things to remember about that movie, things that we liked about that movie. The opening scene, actually, I can remember that the most because they revive Jason by they stick like a it's like a fence post down to his heart, and then,
and then the
bolt of lightning strikes it, and he comes back to life. So, yeah, that's really unbelievable. But it nonetheless begins the zombie Jason. There's the paintball scene in that movie where, you know, a group of, I think it's corporate executives or something, are out shooting paintball. And Jason's in the woods, and he slices through three of them at one time in one scene. It's just there's scenes like that that you really remember.
The scene with I think the character's name is Court when they're in the
RV
or whatever. Yeah. That was a cool scene there too. I guess we're gonna play the second clip now, though. We've talked enough about part six, I suppose. We asked Betsy Palmer about seeing Friday the 13th and her experiences at the theater seeing the original movie. So here's her response on that.
Bill opened twice.
Right.
Once before it was released. Once on Mother's Day that my daughter and I went to see it and came in Connecticut.
Kind of hard to believe she's only seen the film like two times.
I guess, well, if you listen to her read a lot of more of her interviews, you know, she doesn't really like watching any of her films, so I guess that should be no exception.
And we realize, like, the quality isn't as good as the ones we've done here, but we still appreciate, like, Randy Gasson helping us out with that. And if you want to read the whole interview with Betsy, clearly you can read it on horrornewsletter.com. He's got an issue, it's Holiday with the Voorhees, that he did back in December. It's got Ari Lehman on there, too, who was the original Jason. And it's a killer interview. Both of those interviews are really well done. So now we move forward, which is another... for some reason, I don't know, I must have just not been thinking. I thought this movie would actually be rated the number one movie by the fans. This was part seven, The New Blood, which was Jason versus Carrie, sort of. You
want to talk about, you know, taking... They were really starting to... In part seven... Well, in part six, they started to take things a little bit, you know, obscurely unbelievable.
Right.
But in part seven, they really took it to a new level. They had the, you know, the chick that had ESP in the...
Laura Park Lincoln.
Yeah, Laura Park Lincoln. And, you know, fighting Jason, which this was the first... Friday the 13th movie with Kane Hodder, who is universally recognized as the Jason just because he's been in more than one movie.
Yeah.
One Friday 13.
Jean-Carl Beekler, I'm supposing that's how I tried looking up how you pronounce his name, directed the film, and he did the special effects for the film. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the most memorable things about the movie itself was the amazing effects. I mean,
the Jason bodysuit.
Yeah.
The spinal cord Jason, as it's called. That's definitely by far the best, in my opinion, Jason that there ever has been.
Yeah.
As far as looks.
And this is the debut of Kane Hodder as Jason. And it's a fitting debut, seeing as it's the best Jason ever looked, pretty much.
Really is.
I'm not positive on this, but I think this film had the most death scenes.
It did, according to a lot of different websites.
There's a lot of them that got cut out. I know on the new box set, new now, but...
Actually, if you include Freddy vs. Jason, that movie had the most death scenes.
I don't include that.
Yeah, I don't either. I'm just saying. a couple things to remember about Part 7, that I remember about Part 7, though, is it's another movie where they had to reanimate Jason, because he's supposedly, in Part 6, Tom Matthews tied him to a boulder and threw him over the side of a boat, and he's supposedly trapped at the bottom of the lake.
Mm-hmm.
So... And this is one of the best scenes in the movie, actually, for sheer comedy value. Laura Park Lincoln uses her ESP powers to try to summon her dad, who also, I'm thinking, died and drowned in the lake or something to that effect when she was a kid there.
Right.
And accidentally summons Jason back to life in the opening scenes.
Yeah.
So, it's just stuff like that that's really memorable about these movies.
Well, let's be serious. I mean, you're watching a freaking Friday the 13th.
Yeah.
It doesn't have to have freaking, like, Casablanca-type story behind it.
They didn't even need to do that crap. All they needed to do was show him ripping the chain off. I mean, it's understood that he's dead.
Mm-hmm.
He's a zombie by now, so. Just have him come up and start killing people. You don't need to bring all that, stuff like that into it. But as far as death scenes in that movie go, there's a couple that I do remember that are always pretty cool. One of them is there's a doctor in the movie that's played by
Dr. Kaiser.
Bernie.
Yeah.
Yeah, from Wicked at Bernie's. And he gets I'm thinking it's a weed eater with a metal blade on it.
Yeah.
Yeah, taken to the insides of it.
Yeah.
And that was always, I don't know, I always remember that really well.
The thing about, like, at least most of the stuff that I remember from Part 7, it's like most of the death scenes are cut.
They are. That's,
you can't really see. I mean, the NBA really, they really slaughtered the movie. I mean, but maybe one day we'll get the uncut DVD out. Who knows?
There's a scene in that, at the movie, at the end of it, where Laura Park Lincoln's character causes everything to catch on fire, or she pours gasoline, on Jason, and causes it to ignite, and he catches on fire.
And there's another part, too, where she hangs Jason with her, by an electric cord or something with her, psychic power. And I always love the part, too, where Jason's mask, how does his mask come off? It's something that happens.
She just starts staring at him.
And his mask, that's right. And when his mask comes off, that's fucking awesome, flat out.
Yeah, the
way they did that, I don't know if it was... And I don't know how they did that, but that was killer.
It kind of looks like a Muppet, but it's it's killer.
I thought it was killer.
Yeah, it really is. The makeup is really good.
And it was definitely killer compared to the way Jason looked in the next movie.
Oh, yeah.
But I'm not... See, here's what makes this movie special to me, okay? It's considered, not as good as the other films, right?
Mm-hmm.
But this was the first Friday the 13th, and technically the last Friday the 13th I ever saw in the theater, because this was the last film that used the title Friday the 13th, which I don't know why. I don't know if New Line can't use that name or what. Maybe somebody could email me and tell me. I watched this movie in the theater when I was like 9 years old, and it's just always, I don't know, it's always held a special place in my heart just because of that, and I just remember... seeing it, it's really, Jason only takes Manhattan for the last half hour of the movie, really.
Jason ain't taking much in this movie, really. He's not.
It's they're on a ship for most of the film. And there's some cool death scenes in it, no doubt. One of my favorite ones was with the lava rocks.
Mm-hmm. And the sauna.
Yeah.
And another thing to remember about this movie is it's got Kelly Hugh in it.
Yeah.
If anybody ever seen
that. She's with the evil bitch that wants to do drugs or that does drugs.
That's another thing that's always became really prevalent in these movies. Yeah, you always have to have the asshole character.
Yeah.
The one that
whether it's a woman or a man.
Yeah.
There's always at least one asshole.
There's always one asshole character that always deserves to get it and eventually does in the end. But the one thing that I remember most about this movie is it starts to deviate from the formula in this.
Yeah, a little bit.
At the beginning, it's all on a boat.
Right.
And then he comes into Manhattan. And I think the reason why they did that, I think, wasn't that they didn't have enough time to shoot in Manhattan or they didn't have the money.
Actually, they shot most of the film in Canada, I believe.
Yeah.
And they only shot like maybe a day or two in Manhattan because it cost them so much,
so,
I guess.
I think they really wanted to do the whole movie based around him taking Manhattan, but that just didn't happen because of budget restraints. But the first half of the movie is probably a lot closer to a real Jason movie. It's just on a boat. It's like Friday 13th on a boat. And then when they get to New York, it starts, especially the ending.
I'll tell you the ending, really.
Oh,
yeah, that's what I was going to bring up. I never understood the ending. I remember people telling me, it's just a dream. And that seems to be an excuse for everything that's, you can't really explain in these movies. But, all right, first of all, when Jason loses his mask and falls in the acid, what is it? It ain't acid, is
it? It's toxic sewage?
Toxic sewage, which, he looks like a crappy Skeletor, sort of.
The scene where he screams while he's, the toxic sludge.
It just reminds me of, like, Skeletor from, like, Masters of the Universe.
That truly looks like a freaking Halloween mask or something. I don't know who did that.
He melts down to a boy. A regular-looking boy, too, by the way.
Well, he's kind of got one jacked-up eye.
Oh,
it looks
he?
Like somebody put it on with a, felt-tip pen or something.
Anyway, I don't know. I love Friday the 13th Part 8, too. I mean, it's not as good as the other ones, but I've watched it as many times as I watched the other ones. I mean, bottom line,
it's the beginning of the end, if you really want to be honest about it. But it's actually the last film in that series that you can still watch and, enjoy.
Well, I can watch them all and enjoy them. That's just me. But
I don't know. When you start getting to these next couple, when you get to Jason Goes to Hell and Jason
They're not as good as the others, but you know what I'm saying. This next clip we've got of Betsy Palmer, a lot of the fans want to know how to get in contact, or not exactly how to get in contact with her, but just if she replies to fan mail and stuff like that, and this is how you can go about getting her autograph. So check this out. This is a really cool clip, especially if you're into autograph collecting and emailing or messaging your stars or whatever. So check this next clip out. How to get in contact with Betsy Palmer on Dead Pit.
One of our esteemed people in charge of deadpit.com, which is doing the interview right now for us. One of the things that they had really talked a lot in detail is they're surprised that with your article you talked a little bit about people contacting you from all over the world. Do you still receive quite a bit of email?
I've got not email. I get fan mail.
Right.
It's never email. I have no email.
Okay.
I have no email address. I'm computer illiterate.
Okay.
No, I have a table which today I was going through this. It's going to take me 2 days. I get fan mail from all over the world. From Malaysia, there was a couple of sisters from Sweden that their letters on the table now, and I answer all my own mail. And I usually write on their letters and everything, that I thank them and that I'm grateful that they enjoy me and stuff like that. And a lot of people, of course, they send you a
or something, but a lot of people don't. I just had one from a young boy, 15 years old, that has 3 pages of typewritten names, all of politicians, that his grandfather has received autographs for. I mean, it goes on 3 major pages of all of these political names, and I'm going to write to him and say, what do you want from me? I'm not in politics. You know, I'll send him a picture, and well, I won't send him a big picture because he didn't send an envelope. I'm tired of buying all the envelopes and all the postage, so if they send it, fine. If not, well, then I'll send back a little note and say, sorry. You know, if you send an envelope, I'll send it and write a little message.
So if you want to know how to, you know, if Betsy answers fan mail, there you go.
Yeah, I mean, it's not too hard. I'm just going to steer you in the right direction. Just do a search on Yahoo for one word, horror graphs, and it's not too hard to find her address from there if you want to write to old Betsy.
Now we're going to move on to the, in my opinion, and I'm sure a lot of other people's opinions, even if you absolutely love the series, the 2 weakest films in the Friday 13th series, right here.
Right, well, yeah.
Starting with the movie that actually we've both seen probably the most times in the theater.
Yeah, I saw it twice in the theater. Yeah.
So, Jason Goes to Hell, which...
Right.
In all honesty, is not really a Friday the 13th movie in the classic sense, as, you know, it's not... They go to Camp Crystal Lake or another camp and start, you know, getting picked off by a killer. It actually incorporates some kind of really, really crappy Night of the Creeps slash...
Hidden.
Yeah, hidden.
Yeah, Jack Shoulder probably should sue somebody from the idea, but... You see, you don't really see Jason in the movie for, what, maybe 15, 20 minutes throughout the whole movie?
Yeah. Jason starts taking the form.
And I don't know if that's even that bad of a thing, because the way Jason looked in this movie, it's probably my least favorite Jason... design.
Well, I don't think they really even thought about how they were going to design him. He's not even movie enough to worry about that.
Well, yeah, but they just had the mask look like he melted. It was melted on his face, and he had like a deformed, you know, sort of look.
But we're trying to stay positive.
Bubbly, like acid type stuff. Anyway.
Because there's too many pussies that don't like us being negative.
Not just about that. The thing is, even as much as these movies aren't good compared to the other Friday movies, to me, they're still better than a lot of the stuff that comes out today, flat out. I mean,
well, as far as
I would, hey, if I knew I could see a movie that had the gore that Jason Goes to Hell had in it, and, you know, had a great score in it, too. Harry Manfredini did the score in this movie, which is another awesome bit of music that he did. I would go and see a film like that, flat out.
Just for the gore, I mean, this probably has my absolute, one of my favorite death scenes in any movie, and actually, I really couldn't believe, like, how graphic
it's
it was.
It's actually in the unrated version.
Yeah, in the unrated version of the DVD.
Right.
Is the scene where the woman's having sex in the tent.
Yeah.
And Jason comes up behind her and sticks, I don't know what it is, a spear? It's some kind of
rod
or something. Through her smaller back and goes up all the way through until her...
Oh, yeah, man, that's...
until her head...
Yeah, that's a great scene. I remember when they had the unrated videos of those. You remember with the embossed cover, sort of? And I was like, damn, I want to get that. And, you know, when it come out, I don't know if you remember back in the day when movies came out, they would always come out in the video store a good 6 months before you could buy them.
Mm-hmm.
And I was looking at everywhere. I didn't know. I was looking at wherever we're wanting to buy that, the unrated version. Jason Goes to Hell, it's... Maybe if it wasn't Jason in the movie, if it was just a regular horror movie that had that same sort of story to it, I would like it better. But it's not a Friday the 13th type movie. It just isn't.
No, and that's what pissed a lot of people off that were into that series, is that... is by no means anything like a Friday the 13th movie.
Yeah.
Just in name only, really. And by the way, the ending of this movie, if a lot of people remember this or not, was the setup for Freddy vs.
Right.
Jason.
That's right. And that was like 10 years before the movie actually came out, I believe.
It has the scene at the very end where the Freddy's claw comes up and grabs Jason.
We should really ask somebody. I wonder if that really was Freddy's laugh and Robert Englund's arm.
Yeah, I guess we probably will eventually get to ask somebody that question.
I always wondered that, but we go on, and this was a long delay between films. The longest ever for the franchise, actually, was Jason Goes to Hell come out in 93, and Jason X come out, what was it, 2002?
Yeah.
I think it was actually filmed a year earlier, but
we went to see this movie in the theater, and this was actually, you know, when we knew that we had a really good interest in horror movies, and we were actually looking forward, and it had been so long since Jason Goes to Hell came out.
Yeah.
And let me just say this about it before we start talking about it. Anytime anybody in any franchise, but especially horror, puts somebody in space, the movie's not going to be that good.
Yeah.
That's just space facts.
It was okay movie, though. I mean, you have Kane Hodder, which, unfortunately, it was his last role as Jason, at least up to this point. I thought it had some really creative death scenes in it. One of my favorite ones was where they stick the girl's head in liquid nitrogen and bust her face. That was a cool scene. That was creative, at least. That was something different.
If you want to know a plot to this movie, I suggest you go on IMDb.com. But the thing that I remember, if you want to know the complete plot, the thing I remember about it is it's way ahead in the future. I think it's like 50 years in the future. And Jason is cryogenically frozen, as happens, seems with every
movie. It's originally set about 50 years in the future. David Cronenberg, you remember, he's in the movie.
He's the scientist that it's trying to find a way to freeze Jason.
Yeah, so I think it is like Jason somehow gets unfrozen. I haven't seen the movie in a little while. What it is, Jason is chained up first, right? He's in like a, you know, a futuristic
sort of cell, right? Hannibal Lecter-ish looking outfit at the beginning of it.
And David Cronenberg wants to study him, right? He's the one that wants to study Jason.
They're keeping him pretty much in captivity, and they're trying to take samples of his blood and stuff and figure out what it is that makes him not be able to be killed and all that
stuff.
I think
they want to use it for a futuristic army or something cool like that. So Jason somehow gets free and kills Cronenberg.
Mm-hmm.
How could he do that?
I don't know. In reality, though, Cronenberg is never going to die. So.
And
watch the brood.
Alexa Doig, right? Is she the star in the movie? I can't look on here.
Shit, I don't know.
Canadian actress. She's the one that fights with Jason in the 50 years in the future deal. And they both get cryogenically frozen in like a cell or something. Some shit like that.
Oh, it's shitty. It's just shitty now. Come on.
I can't believe I actually loosely remember this. I've probably seen the movie two or three times. And so I think it's another 400 years in the future. Until they get unfrozen, right?
Yeah.
And then you meet the new cast. You've got like a hot robot with, you know, that's like a karate expert and shit, you know. I don't know. I don't know if I can talk about this movie much longer. But I'm just going to say.
Yeah, it's giving me a fucking headache.
I'm just going to say that the movie is in the 550 bin, right? It's worth $5.50 to me.
Yeah, just for
It's got the DVD itself.
Liquid nitrogen scene.
The DVD itself has a killer documentary on it, I remember. The Many Lives of Jason Voorhees. But, yeah, it's a good movie. But another thing I remember about it is Harry Manfredini's score in the movie. Great score. You can check it out on his website, too,
That's
by the way.
That's one of the only redeeming values in this movie is the score. So
yeah, you could tell he was sort of really inspired too with the space setting and things like that.
The gore in this movie has been toned down a lot too. I think in the time between Jason Goes to Hell and this movie, the MPAA really started to change on the rating system.
Another cool thing, though, before we go to the second half of the Harry Manfredini interview, one cool thing was the flashback sequence. Do you remember that?
Where they go with the hologram.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I thought that was a pretty good scene.
There's a scene in, I'm thinking, is it Friday? What is it? Six?
It would probably be six. With the
where Jason picks up a sleeping bag that has a woman in it, and bashes it up against a tree, and that's how he kills her.
Yep.
Well, this kind of harkens back to that scene, and if you've seen the movie, you know what the scene is, and it really is a funny scene. It kind of pays homage to the...
That's one thing I sort of forgot about, but it's a good scene. Get the movie. I mean, it's $5.50. What the hell? I mean, it's not like the $5.50 bin has much anything better to offer.
That's true.
So pick that up. I mean, if you haven't got it, you might as well add it to your Friday collection. I mean, that's why.
That's our best recommendation is you might as well buy it because you can't buy anything better for $5.50.
You really can't. we're going to play the second part of the Harry Manfredini interview. And we hope you all enjoy it. We'll be back right after the interview to talk about the last installment of the Friday the 13th saga, at least on January 13th, 2006. We're here on DeadPit.com, and this is the Friday the 13th special on DeadPit.com.
Cronenberg rules!
There seems to be, I've noticed a lot of the films you do scores for, a kind of sparseness to the way that you put the music in. Is that purposeful?
I couldn't tell you. Some people tell me I overscore sometimes. But I do like it to be sparse.
Uh-huh.
And I also tend to write a different way than other people. I tend to think of things sort of, for lack of a better term, in strata, sort of like layer cakes of things. And I may use three things or four or two or... of layers of things, and I sort of build. I kind of build on it contrapuntally rather than think of it as a sort. I think of it sort of horizontally as opposed to vertically. I don't know if that makes any sense to you, but I do like it sparse because first of all, it just has more of a linear sort of feel that moves forward in a sort of moving kind of thing without being so punctuated, I guess.
I've noticed that there's usually like a violin in the background,
right,
keeping time. Then you'll bring forward the brass,
right,
and kind of, you know, especially.
You know, I'll tell you, you're very observant. I want to meet you guys someday. What I like to think of in now I'll get banal with you, okay?
Okay.
Think of it as a clothesline, okay? Think of the piece of music as a clothesline. It starts here and it ends over there, okay?
Okay.
So sometimes I just try to create a clothesline. So I have an idea that this is going to go from there to there. And then I start to, and I look at the drama of what's there, whether it happens to be a piece of dialogue or whether it's a camera move, or whether it's a cot, or whether it's, you know, the gun in the drawer, or whatever it happens to be.
Mm-hmm.
And I find those places on the clothesline.
And fill in the pieces with the...
And then I work in that way. And it almost becomes like a mosaic, where this takes us to that. And then I think about, I feel like I'm building a house here, like construction of how you blend it in so no one knows. It comes in and nobody notices that it's there, or it goes out and nobody notices that it left.
But subconsciously they do notice
it. Of course, that's where I'm playing. I'm playing to your subconscious. What I'm saying is that also sometimes, and this I started also with Friday the 13th, with Sean, I said, you know, sometimes silence is a better hit than a piece of music. I said, sometimes let's hit it with the music stopping rather than with the music starting.
Yeah.
Like, if you want to emphasize something, sometimes you start a piece of music on it. But sometimes if you want to emphasize something, you emphasize it by stopping the music.
Mm.
You know? And the other thing is that, I mean, you guys are actually asking very creative and intelligent questions. I have to give you kudos on that.
Well, I appreciate it.
Well, this is good. I mean, for example, the next thing, when you go back and look at Friday the 13th again, next time watch when the music stops and when the music starts, and you'll notice that just about every time before something really horrific happens, the music goes out.
So purposely reverse the usual
pattern.
Purposely,
well, because if you think of yourself, remember the old carnival thing, you know, where you hit the thing and the thing went up to ring the bell.
Oh, the
you know,
the strong man.
Yeah, the strong man thing, right? You know, okay. Well, let's suppose the bell is the scariest you can get.
Uh-huh.
Okay, and obviously the least scary you can get is you're down at the bottom. You know, the thing is just down there. Just if nothing's happening. What's happening is that in a horror film, if I'm like, if there's this big chase and it's scary. What's happening is that that thing is edging its way up towards the bell.
So the bell is reserved for the big scare.
The bell is the big scare. But what I try to do is that if you're already at a 7, and the most I'm going to get out of you is a 10. Okay.
Yeah.
There's really only a 3 to go. So my job is to get you up to the 7 and then all the way back down to 2 or 3. I got to get you to relax. Because if you don't relax, the more you relax, the bigger the scare. Vis-a-vis our end credits, you know, where everybody was like totally, yeah. Like put to sleep. You know, like it was just like nothing could possibly happen. You know, what could happen? It's over. And then, and you were back down at 0, and whack, you got your 10. So it's the same sort of thing. I mean, I could show you many times in that picture where she's running and she's afraid, and all of a sudden she thinks she's okay. As soon as she thinks she's okay, somewhere in there, just before that, I'll pull the music out. Mm-hmm. I'll just wind it down, and all at once she'll go like, whew, oh, okay. And then, bam! You see, so you think of it as, you know, manipulating the level of tension. Of course, then you've got your infamous red herrings, which, of course, you're building to something that's not going to pay off, at least horrifically. So in that case, you actually drive harder.
Like the cat jumping out of the closet?
Say that again.
Like the cat jumping out of the closet?
Like the cat jumping out of the closet, or at the end of, you know, like, I was thinking, I think it's part 2 or something. But, you know, all these movies, they blur in my mind.
Yeah.
But somewhere it was like, oh, my God, oh, my God, oh, my God. And it was like the dog from Real One. Oh, look, it's Muffy, you know. You know, and, oh, gee, isn't that cute? It's a little dog, you know. And then, of course, nobody notices there's a window behind these two people about the size of Pittsburgh, you know, that obviously somebody is going to come through. But the thing is that, you know, you're trying to distract them with the sound that's at the door, and, oh, my God, someone's coming through the door. You know, and, of course, it's Muffy, and then everybody relaxes, and then, whack. But, you know, those of us who've seen too many horror films don't get...
Which would include us, yeah.
Which would include, you know, a lot of people. You don't get fooled that easily. I mean, I don't know if you guys had the same reaction. I mean, I was, like, rolling in the aisles laughing at, what was the Michael Douglas movie with the crazed woman? Fatal Attraction?
Yep.
I was laughing so hard at that movie I could hardly stand it. You know, because it attracted an audience that, you know, weren't horror people. They were just like, you know, your regular, oh, it's a thriller Michael Douglas thing.
Yeah.
And there were so many things in there that I was just laughing at. I mean, I said, could they shoot to that gun? Could they cut to that gun in the drawer more times? I mean, how many times do we have to see the gun in the drawer before everyone in the world knew there's a gun in the drawer? Or remember when the bunny, she gave the daughter the bunny?
Uh-huh.
You know, I looked over and I said, if that bunny makes it through this reel, you've got a big surprise. Because the only reason that bunny is in this movie is to be killed. You know what I mean? You, it's kind of rotten that, you know, you get to get so jaded, but I mean, it was so many horror cliches in that movie.
Yeah, you can tell a lot of times when the set pieces in a film are going to come up again.
In a movie like that, I mean, they might as well have just put arrows on the screen, you know, watch this, you know.
There was another song I wanted to mention to you about that. I read the Crystal Lake Memory book, and I don't think it was mentioned.
You read the Crystal Lake Memory book?
Well, I'm not all the way through. I've skimmed through it.
Wow. Okay.
That's a good book, by the way.
I love Peter. He's the greatest guy. I wish if you were out here, they had this big bash.
Yeah.
I don't know if you saw the pictures on the website.
No.
If you go to my website, there's pictures from the bash. For the opening of the book, the release of the book, and there were, like, you know, lots of people, you know, fans invited, and there were hundreds of books, and for, like, $75, you got the book, you got free food, you got the party, and then we all hung around together and signed books and stuff, and a lot of people were there. Even Jason showed up, and he cut the birthday cake with his machete. It was pretty funny. it was a lot of fun. If you go to my website, there's pictures there.
Okay, well, that's HarryManfredini.com.
Yes, it is.
I was going to ask you about the disco theme, I guess.
The disco thing, right.
How did that come about? Whose idea was that?
I don't know.
I always thought that was a really cool theme and everything, but I just never understood, like, why it was in the movie, really.
It was just there because it was there. It was disco time. It was the time for disco.
That theme was actually, it was in the movie again, I think, in the, where they're in the supermarket, right?
I hate to tell you, okay, I'm going to give you a little more, unless you've read the book about me, I don't know.
No.
In part three, which is, that's where that was, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Okay. Every question has a story, doesn't it? Okay. Remember when I told you I wrote this song called Sail Away, Tiny Sparrow?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I wrote this song called Sail Away, Tiny Sparrow, and just put it in that movie. It just literally wrote it to fill in the diner scene. Little did I know, you know. And the only reason I used it at the end, I'm saying, like, hey, this is a great melody. Why not use it?
Yeah.
So, subsequently, about a year later, a friend of mine says, you know, he was a singer in New York, and he says, you know, you wrote that the country song for the movie? Yeah. He says, do you ever write any other country songs? I said, yeah, I wrote a couple just, you know, it's source music, blah, blah, blah. And he says, well, I got a couple of country songs. He goes, you know, I think we could probably, like, put together a really interesting little review with a bunch of country songs if we wrote a few more together. And I said, cool, why not? Anyway, push comes to shove, and I've got a musical on Broadway called Play Me a Country Song, okay, of which Sail Away, Tiny Sparrow is one of the songs in the musical. Okay. Mm-hmm. It didn't make it. It didn't run. Obviously, you would have heard about it, and I would be filthy rich and retired now.
Making residuals.
And making residuals, and we wouldn't even be talking.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm glad it didn't happen. So, but anyway, I was doing this musical, and at that time, Steve was doing Friday 3. Mm-hmm. And I was putting in, I don't know, 100 hours a week on this musical because we were just putting it together and in rehearsal and in the theater and all these different things. And I said, Steve, I said, I can't. He says, look, he says, all I need for you to do is do the first reel and the last reel. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
He says, and I'll take the music from the first two, which we already have, and I'll make the score of the rest of the film out of the first two.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, okay, if that's what you want to do. So I only scored the first reel and the last reel. Now, here's the part you're not going to believe.
Okay.
I've never seen Friday Part 3. I know you're not going to believe it, but I've never actually seen it all the way through.
Hmm.
I saw the beginning and the end. So if you tell me that that piece is playing in a grocery store, I believe you.
Okay. We'll tell you it's playing all the way through.
Okay, well, I believe you then, which is nice.
But
no, I mean, we just did that as a disco thing. We thought it was a sort of a cool idea, and you never know. You take a shot.
It's actually, I mean, to be honest, one of my favorite themes.
It is cool.
We did it, and a friend of mine produced it, and also got, I'm trying to think of the guy who worked on it. He was a big disco producer. And it was cool, sort of interesting. Michael Zager, right.
That worked on, I believe.
Yeah, he worked on it, yeah. And I just gave him some stuff, and we kicked it around. I said, you know, we should do this and do that. And then he came up, he took some of the stuff, you know, and just sort of turned it into a disco thing. At the moment, there's a theory right now that we're about to revisit a possibility of a sort of a Friday the 13th remix CD of like various things from different films, and then have like people add tracks and add a dance beat or something.
Yeah.
I have no idea. I just go like, okay, if you think, oh, I think we could really do something cool. Well, if you think so, let me know. So there's a theory about that happening. So
brace
yourself.
Yeah. I know that you've done about all of the Friday the 13th movies, but didn't do Freddy versus Jason.
I didn't do Freddy versus Jason. I didn't do 7 and 8.
Oh.
I didn't do 7 and 8 because I was working on other movies. I'm one of these people who actually writes the music that is in the movie.
Yeah.
I don't know if you understand the irony of what I just said. In other words, like...
As opposed to bands that...
As opposed
write
to...
Write music and just... Or not for the movie, but it just gets put in there anyway now?
No, as opposed to some guy who puts his name on the movie and actually somebody else wrote it.
Oh, okay.
I don't use any ghosts.
Oh. Yeah, I really felt like they were using the rock music, modern stuff for Freddy vs. Jason. I don't know. It just didn't work that well.
That's another movie I didn't see. At one point, I read probably 10 Freddy versus Jason scripts.
Wow.
One of which I actually was going to play a part. I was going to be Mr. Booger. and that was sort of cool because actually the guy who had written it was Louis Abernathy, who is actually wrote Deep Star 6, which I did.
Mm-hmm.
And he directed House 4. I think it was in House 4. That was the one with the pizza. I was the pizza in House 4.
Oh, really?
I sang the part of and played the part of the pizza. So I guess if I can do a pizza, I could probably do a booger. So,
mm-hmm.
And there was a scene in his script where Freddy got stuck in somebody's nose, and he met a booger, and I was going to be the booger. So it was. I mean, I'm telling you right now, it was the most brilliant of any of the scripts that I read, and I thought that the last one, which is the one that they made, was probably the worst.
Uh-huh.
That picture was on the table for a long, long time.
Yeah,
I'm taking another drink.
Okay.
Water. And I didn't see the picture. I was, and they decided, of course, they didn't use Kane as Jason, and they didn't use me because I guess they thought it was going to be, they wanted to make everything new. And then I have to admit I've heard, you know, bits and pieces of the music, you know, this has got nothing to do with Graham, but, you know, I'm just going like, it sounds like the same stuff, just, you know, more expensive. They spent a lot of money, and I would have enjoyed having a lot of money, but they didn't use me, so fine, that's, whatever it is, it's their,
Yeah, it seems like a lot of the newer movies, too, are just, I don't know, they're just sampling music from MTV and stuff like that.
Yeah, I don't know. I guess they were going for a different crowd or something. I don't understand. It's whatever it is, it's their choice. You remember, it's their bat and ball. And,
right.
So I didn't get to do it. You know, I wanted to do it. It would have been okay with me to do it, and I would have done a great job, but that's the way...
It's just one of those things, I suppose.
That's showbiz, as they say.
Yeah.
It's okay. So what else you got? Come on, you guys. You got good questions here.
Well, you've done comedies, you've done dramas, you've done horror films, you've done even family movies for Disney, I think.
Right.
So what would you say would be your
favorite? I don't have a bag. Yeah. What's my favorite movie?
Your favorite type of genre, I guess, to write for, compose for.
Well, they all have their, positives and negatives. The fun thing about doing horror films or slasher films is that you're pretty much wide open. I mean, it's sort of like there is no
carte blanche type of thing.
It's literally carte blanche. Any sound I want, I can. It's way more. It's just I can literally can take from anything I want. If I want to come up with a sound that I think is a cool sound, they're good with it. I can go back into the classical. I can go into as far out musically as I want to get, to where it's totally aleatoric and it's just whatever comes, and rhythmically it's open. I mean, it's just so free.
Mm-hmm.
That as long as you can, affect the picture correctly and manipulate the feelings of the audience and stuff like that, you're pretty wide open. I mean, a director says to you, I want a cello. Okay, well, how often do you get to use two cellos and two French horns? I mean, it just doesn't come up in very many films. You know, so in a way, there's a certain freedom and there's a certain fun about that. At the moment, actually, I was just talking to a director. I'm doing a picture called Dead and Gone, coming up the middle of the year. And one of the things we're going to do is that we've got this little toy. It's kind of a toy that sounds like a baby crying, But we're going to sample it and fool around with it and try to come up with a sound and use it rhythmically and use it as a sound in the score. That doesn't really happen very often. So you get a chance in a horror picture. You can, like you said, carte blanche. Your palette is pretty much wide open. That being said, comedies are fun to do. They're harder to do because what's funny to some people is not quite funny to others. But again, you're a little wider open and. So that's sort of fun to do. I like doing children's films because they're lighthearted, and I like doing that. I mean, I like doing all of them. I mean, they each have their people always. Some people say to me, "God, you're so good at comedy. You should do comedies." And I go, "Okay, fine. Give me a comedy. I'll do it." don't stop. Don't let me stop. You go ahead. Give me a comedy to do. But unfortunately, you get noted for a certain style, so you get the, bulk of the...
There's probably not a lot of room in comedies or dramas for props, like, the baby you were talking about, like there is in horror.
In horror. Well, but you'd be surprised. I have this sort of dramatic theory, and if you want, I'll share it with you.
Sure.
We remember we were talking about expectations before, and I think that comedy and horror, or let's call it funny and scary, I think that they run on a continuum that's not a straight line, that they're really related, and it's sort of like a circle. And if you think of the top of the circle as being sort of like neither funny nor scary, just your basic... four square, nothing sort of thing. And if you go to the right on the circle, it gets funnier and funnier and funnier and funnier until you get to the bottom, where it meets at the top of the circle where it goes left, 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 it gets scarier, 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 scarier. And then at the bottom, they sort of meet. And at that point, you've crossed that line. It's no longer funny, it's scary, or it's no longer scary, it's funny.
Many horror films cross that line.
That's what I'm saying is that there's that line, and and it's based on expectations. I mean, like, for example, if you had to walk across a room, and I was sitting there watching you, and, you remember that Tim Conway character on the Carol Burnett show? Remember he used to walk, and it would just, like, take him forever to do everything?
Really slowly, baby steps.
Yeah, really. I mean, just... stupid slow, you know. And it was really, really funny.
Uh-huh.
Because the expectation was, would you go open the door? You know, okay, it's going to take you 15 seconds to walk from, you know, not even 15, 10 seconds to walk to over there to open the door. And if it takes you 35 or 40 seconds, that's pretty funny. So that's funny because the expectations are 4 seconds. I'll just let that ring. But anyway, but what if it only took a sixth of a second? That would be scary.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
The expectation
The expectation was met in the opposite direction. And, but what happens is, like, I mean, in a cartoon, for example, let's say it's a Bugs Bunny cartoon, you know, and it's Elmer Fudd's there, and he goes, Bugs, and the Bugs is here, and he goes, oh, yeah, and then he turns around to get the gun, and he's on the other side, and then he's over there, and then he's over there. It's funny because it's past the line. If it only happened once, it would be scary. Your expectation,
yeah.
And the same thing happens, you know, with funny. It's funny. It's not so funny anymore, you know, and... you know, I mean, things like, you know, the k-k-k sound and the Jaws sound, which mm-hmm. become, you know, which now have become, you know.
Infamous.
But, I mean, like, right now, I put Jaws in a comedy. When you break into Jaws, people laugh. Uh-oh, it's Jaws.
Mm-hmm.
Or same thing with Jason. I mean, two people walking along, and it's a dark, you know, pathway or something, and... one of the goofs in the group goes, you know, next thing
it becomes synonymous with terror, yeah.
But it can be used as something funny.
Yeah.
So you see what I'm saying? So it's really not a, they sort of cross over each other at that one beyond the line. I don't know.
It's so familiar that it kind of gets...
It loses its strength.
Yeah.
It's like somebody putting too many jalapenos in the salt. It's gone beyond. You know, so I'm surprised you haven't asked me about...
Well, I figured everybody else in the world would probably ask you that question. I would leave that one off, but...
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
But I'm glad that you brought it up.
We actually did get an email someone wanted to...
Yeah, we got several emails that people wanted to ask. We asked them to give us questions to ask you.
Right.
And that was the most popular one by far.
Well, of course. But I have to tell you, I just did this is my week for doing this thing. Yesterday, they shot a documentary about the rise and fall of slasher films, and they did 3 hours with me out in this forest somewhere. I was, like, walking through spooky things and talking and answering questions like this. And it came to the... Needless to say, it came to the question.
Uh-huh.
And we were right by a lake, and there was a boat there. And I says, how about if I go in the boat and sit out on the lake and answer the question? And of course they said, cool. You know, so here I am out on this lake, freezing my butt off here, and talking about that particular thing. Well, no, we were talking about the final song. I take that back. We answered somewhere else, but I'll give you the fast story.
Okay.
As I said to you before, I said one of the problems in scoring Friday was the fact that you never saw the killer, and so that the music needed a voice. It needed something that we knew that wasn't just the camera shooting the campgrounds.
Mm-hmm.
This was the person. So every time that happened, it needed to have a voice. It had to be something, and it had to be something very distinctive. And at the time, I was studying, you know, I'm always studying some other music, and I was studying this composer. It's spelled Penderecki, but I think they pronounce it Penderecki. He's a Polish composer. Very, very avant-garde, really, you know, wacky stuff, you know.
Mm.
Quite dramatic music. If you ever get a chance, Krzysztof Penderecki. If you ever get a chance to hear it, and this was a piece. I think it was a requiem or something, but it was incredibly dramatic, like 100 voice choir and huge orchestra. Very, very, very powerful piece. Anyway, I was listening to it, and they were singing in Polish, but they were pronouncing words with great emphasis and very short, hard consonants, and I'm going like, wow, that is so damn dramatic, you know. And then I went, and when I saw the picture, I said, you know, there's that scene at the very end when Mrs. Voorhees, they have the close-up of her mouth, and she says, kill her, mommy, and it goes back from her voice to the, you know, the Jason voice back and forth, and I said to myself, that's what it is. This is a woman who hears voices in her head. She's wacko, you know, she's, people are talking to her, and
no one's there.
And no one's around, and but there was that close-up of the mouth, and that was the inspiration when it said, kill her, mommy, and I just took K-I from kill and M-A from mommy.
Uh-huh.
And then I went, you know, when you say I did it all myself, I went in front of a microphone, and back in the late 70s when this was done, there was this gizmo called an Echoplex machine, and it was a sort of a fancy tape delay, and basically I went up to the mic and I went like that, K-I-M-A, and then the machine would take that sound and go. So that's actually me doing that. And then what I did, and remember I was telling you about the clotheslines, I would just take the piece of music and I'd say, okay, this would be a great place for it, and this would be a great place for it, and this would be a great place for it. And stupid me, rather than just making a tape of it and dropping it in all those places, I literally went back and put that in every place. It took forever. I mean, like every time that happened, I'd be like, okay, I'd tell the engineer, okay, bar 26, beat 3, I'm going to do it. So we'd get to that spot, and then I'd go, you know, and drop it in. So that's literally how that came about.
That's almost as recognizable now as the two notes and Jaws.
It is. My goal in life now is to come up with something that at least, you know, comes up with, you know, at least that big. I'm not sure what it's going to be. But hopefully one of these days they'll go like, well, not only did he do that, but he did this very heartwarming theme too. Speaking of other movies, did you go to the website and listen to any of the other music that's there?
Most of it, yeah.
Did you see that Gonna Car Blonde?
Yeah, that's the first one, I believe.
Right, yeah. That's me playing sax there, and because that's an old jazz thing, and I mean that's like a film noir film.
Mm-hmm.
Which is a whole other kind of thing, and somebody, I really like that film a lot. If you get a chance, get the DVD to that and watch it. You'll really like it.
Well, that's cool.
I've been telling you, you'll really like, you're not, are you listening?
Yeah.
You'll really like it.
Watch it.
You got Billy Bob Thornton, you got John Ritter, you got Kay Lenz, you got, just a great cast.
We'll have to check that out for sure.
No, you definitely, hello, what I tell you, you're really going to like it. And you'll call me back and say, Harry, that was great. And it's totally different.
Well, we just really want to thank you for spending all this time on. We've took up enough of your time.
Well, it was my pleasure. I really enjoyed it. I'm glad that you ran me down.
Yeah. Well, thanks again, and wish you all the luck.
Well, thank you so much. And if you think of something else, give me a shout, and I'll be happy to talk with you more. We'll work out a time.
Okay.
Cool. Thanks a lot.
Thanks a lot, Eric.
See you guys. Bye.
Now we come to the part, and this movie is really a culmination of every fan of horror movies' dream for a long, long time. What if you had the two biggest horror villains in movie history, really, get together in one movie? What would you have?
Michael Myers versus Jason.
Yeah, but unfortunately, all you got was Freddy versus Jason.
Yeah. Freddy versus Jason. As much as I love Halloween and stuff like that, that was the two big icons in the 80s.
Yeah.
Horror movies. As you heard Manfred Ennie say, though, in the interview, there were 10 scripts of that film before they finally made it, and there were at least 10 years. Because we know that they were thinking of it when Jason Goes to Hell came out in 93, and this finally came out in 2003.
So. Well, the thing about this movie is another movie we saw at the theater,
Of when course, that's all. We have to see it.
Yeah, when you were a kid, this is the kind of stuff you dreamt about. I mean, you dreamt about, if you grew up in the 80s anyway, you dreamt about these kind of versus matchup. And unfortunately, because of this movie, you've got movies like Alien versus Predator out right now, but that's an entirely different story. But I just, yeah, it had so many different scripts that when the final script that got made into the movie, it was a little convoluted, actually. I remember a backstory about they had covered up everything that happened at Elm Street and given kids drugs to make to where they wouldn't remember anything. Yeah. And Freddy was trying to, you know, reincarnate Jason to get him to kill people.
One thing in the movie that I always remember.
Seriously.
And I was like, damn, this girl's being really, like, observant or something. You remember the scene where they're all, like, around, like, a table, like the teenagers and stuff?
Mm-hmm.
And one of them was like, I think it was a girl, and she goes, well, what if Jason is working with Freddy in his dreams or whatever like that? And I was like, what? Who the hell wrote that? I mean, come on.
That's like the Scooby-Doo ending where everything, you know, she figures everything out all of a sudden.
I don't know. The movie's a fun movie, though. I mean, I got to be honest. It's not a Friday the 13th movie, really. It's got Jason in it. It feels more like a Nightmare on Elm Street movie. And I think they meant to do that since New Line Cinema was Freddy's home.
The thing that I really like about this movie, though, is, besides the body count, which if you're a fan of horror movies, it has the biggest body count of any horror movie. I don't know if you knew that or not. But aside from that, is the way it was shot is not that bad. I mean, it was fast-paced. There was a lot of gore. There was actually some nudity. And, you know, it was, right, for new horror films, it's not that bad. The only problem is the ending's really horrible. The plot's, like, for a horror movie.
You could definitely tell that they wanted to make a franchise out of this.
And they probably will.
Yeah. Still. I mean, I think Sean Cunningham is working on Freddy vs. Jason 2. I mean, the early stages of it. The film, though, you could definitely tell New Line was on Freddy's side. Freddy was the smart one. He was the one, you know, tricking Jason. Jason's a big dumbass. And speaking of which,
yeah, I know what's coming.
Jason, remarkably grows half a foot since the last movie.
And why,
he's a giant now for some reason.
Why is that? That's because Ken Kersinger, who is at least 4 inches taller than Kane Hodder, is the guy that plays Jason in this movie.
I don't know. I don't understand the reason behind that. Like,
yeah, it never was really explained, I guess.
I think I remember reading that Kane Hodder mentioned that they wanted, like, Freddy was going to be the smart one, right? They didn't want Kane Hodder, who was only maybe 2 or 3 inches taller than Freddy. They wanted somebody that was huge, that was a giant, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So they picked Kersinger. And to be honest, he doesn't do that bad of a job, really. I mean,
now, as far as walking mongoloids go,
yeah, I mean,
it was great.
That's the thing. But the thing I really, that we talked about in the Man for Danny interview, as you just heard, the music in this movie sucked. Okay?
It really did.
I don't like,
and why?
I love metal music, but I like the stuff that came out in the 70s and 80s. I don't want to hear Chimera and Cattle Decapitation or whoever was on this. I don't like that. That's not in a horror movie. You hear me? I mean, seriously.
Cattle Decapitation? Really?
I don't know if they were on that or not. I'm just throwing out a name of some stupid freaking new metal band.
Yeah. Anytime these movies start to go with modern rock and they start to, instead of like scores and compositions, it always just seems like they're catering to an MTV type of audience. Or not even MTV, they're catering to a preteen type of audience. And that just means that you're marketing to not the real horror fan base, because the real horror fan base for Freddy and Jason movies were people that were around in the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that's really not the people who...
I guess they were thinking, though, you know, what the hell. Let's get our album out on MTV. Let's get a big soundtrack out, you know, stuff like that. But there was a few original compositions in this. Graham Revell, who did the music, did the sound, the score, composition. which was pretty much, you know, as Manfred Annie said, it was a lot of the same stuff.
So, what final thoughts about the film, all in all?
I liked it. I mean, as much as we bad-mouthed it.
I did, too.
Liked it. I mean, it was a good movie. I don't have a problem with it.
A lot of people really don't like this movie for one reason or another, but as far as new horror movies go, that's the thing. Everybody keeps saying to me, you know, I'm not going to lower my standards for new horror movies. Well, yeah, you are.
Yeah.
You have to.
Especially if you compare a movie that came out around the same time. It was another Halloween movie, and that was freaking... that was some of the worst. And if you compare it to that, I don't have a problem with it.
I really don't.
I'd love to see it go back to just the simple formula that it was, but, you know, we're probably not going to get that. But that's fine, I guess. As long as we can keep making movies like that and keep having these Friday the 13th, we'll be happy.
That's right.
So, the last clip we're going to play is we asked Betsy Palmer through Randy Gasson over at Horror Newsletter, which is available at www.horrornewsletter.com, by the way.
Uh-huh.
We asked Betsy Palmer about the Freddy vs. Jason situation, where she was actually offered to come back as Pamela Voorhees. And here is her response.
I was told that that they came to you and asked you if you'd want to do a cameo.
Yeah. But they wouldn't pay money.
Really?
I mean, the second day they were going to give me a strike.
Okay.
Minimum.
Right.
Green Actors Guild minimum.
Yep, I
which
understand.
Which is $200.
Understood.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if it's stupid. Stupid.
Yeah.
You know, the two lines and whatever the heck. I mean, why should I clutter up the great image that we have of Pamela Voorhees in the first movie? See, I never thought I'd ever be speaking this way about this movie, but I really have to defend Mrs. Voorhees. I feel very strongly about her because there's been a lot of input that has come from down deep inside of me that went into her in a strange way. Which is true about all the roles you play if you really identify with. They're all hiding inside of you. An actor. Brain.
Right. You were saying basically was that they offered you SAG amount and that you came back.
So I said, and then they upped the salary and I want to play the game. I kept saying, no, I don't want to do it. So the fans, which are very faithful, dear people, they said, you know, what were they doing? And that one Freddy versus Jason, whom I refuse to admit is my son. This guy behind the hockey mask is not my little boy. My little boy is at the bottom of this lake.
Right, right.
I'm crazy, but I'm not insane. I wouldn't have killed everybody. Or tried to set fire to the camp or poison the water all those years that those other things went on.
Right, right.
No, you know. My kid's down at the bottom.
Your kid was played by Ari Lehman.
Yes, Ari.
I've just I actually did an interview with him about a week and a half ago.
He's a nice guy. He's a very nice guy. And a very talented musician.
A sweet guy. He spoke lovely of you, and he said, you know, the first time he met you was a couple of years ago. He said at a convention, you finally all met together. And he said,
yeah, because I had never seen him. The only one I ever knew was Adrian.
Right, Adrian.
The one that I did the scene with. Because
right.
I never knew anybody else, never saw anybody else.
What'd you
they
think?
Tell me that Kevin Bacon and I are 1 degree of separation or some damn thing like that. But he and I have never met.
Yeah.
And so we've come to the end of the Friday the 13th special. We've got...
I'm sure we've kept you long enough anyway.
Yeah. You really do need to check out the interviews on the site and... You know, we've got transcriptions of the Betsy Palmer interview up on www.horrornewsletter.com. Thanks to Randy for giving that interview. And to everybody that likes the Friday the 13th series, and thank you for tuning in and listening.
Yeah,
to
we
us.
Really want to thank the people over at Friday the 13th Films for letting all the fans know, you know, that we were going to be on. So, you know, and there are plenty of Friday the 13th sites out there that do more than just one show or two shows a year.
Mm-hmm. Camp Crystal Lake Online.
Yeah, and FridayThe13thFilms.com. And both sites are awesome. We just want to thank everybody out there, all the horror fans.
I want to thank Paul Kratka, Harry Manfredini, and Betsy Palmer for the interviews.
And everybody that listened to this long show. Our shows are normally an hour in length.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So check us out every week. We're going to try to start getting more interviews. So just give us an email, too, if you want to see anybody on the show or hear anybody, that is. deadpit@gmail.com. And we'll see you at the theaters.